Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? I always ask that of all my prayer. I just like the sound of it.
Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989.
Baby fish mouth. Apple baby mammy. Fish mouth.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1989, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1989 from a flaming cockpit here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Cope.
And with us today, ready to go down to flames, is David Iserson. Thank you so much for coming on to talk.
Of course.
Talk always with us. It's always a pleasure to have you. It's going to be that kind of podcast.
Yeah, it's the nicest thing you could say about the movie always is to like literally just use the word always in the context of it. Yeah.
David, how you been? It's good to see you again.
I guess how has anybody been? I mean, I think that it's the My de facto answer, that was what I said to like the dog groomer yesterday. It's like, how have you been? I'm like, you know, how are people?
you know is the answer because they do know.
Yeah.
But at least now, you know what I like is like, at least now everybody is doing as shitty as I normally am, but I have to pretend I'm doing fine. Right.
It's flattened so everybody out to one place.
How are you? Oh, I'm doing great. No, it's how are you? I'm doing the same as you, which is terribly.
Well, so you as a person who's saying that you like your baseline is shitty, are you shittier or you like feel like you level? You're just shitty. Nothing changes.
I'm a baseline. I'm a person who operates in a state of low grade depression at all time. And it's nice to have everybody there with me. You know, now I feel like in the mental health rat race, we're all kind of running at the same pace.
Yeah, well, I think that's vaguely hopeful because it's just like you're not worse because everyone is worse. So external factors don't affect your baseline. So that feels, I don't know. There's something about
there's something comforting about the fact that I think of this sort of what Kenny was alluding to, this idea that like when other people now talk to me about like mental health stuff and how they feel, it makes me go like, yeah, no, that's what I'm like all the time. Welcome to the pool. The water's warm.
It's nice to kind of be all in this together in a bad way. I mean, it's like, it's a weird thing. You know, everybody talks about there are going to be, you know, several pandemic set films that are going to be boring and no one's going to want to watch them. And part of that is because it's not a unique experience. You know, even like watching a Holocaust movie, that is a unique experience that I have not had. And, you know, but everybody knows what it's like to do their entire lives over Zoom. There's nothing novel or interesting. There's no angle we haven't looked at this from. That said, I am going to watch the Doug Liman movie because I haven't committed a heist during the pandemic.
Yeah, yeah, that's the part. That's there's the wish fulfillment. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I mean, with your wife, nonetheless. So, like, you know, how you often know that? Does that
I told you that's. I told you that.
That's your dream.
I did. I said to Laura, you know, we've always made fun of people at their weddings or whatever who call their spouse their partners in crime as if you guys are committing crimes. But I really like my true dream with my wife is for her to be my actual partner in crime. So I do see a lot of wish fulfillment in that movie.
I mean, I think the like a thing I can say about the movie without seeing it is whatever it is, I don't think Doug Liman's like – quarantine experience is the same as ours. I don't think he's like coming in with the same sort of perspective as the rest of us. So
yeah, that seems fair. So David, when I reached out to you for you to come on this Patreon, we talked about this movie a little bit, mm-hmm. and you said that you hadn't seen it in a very long time, right? I mean, I think similar to myself, it's been at least 15, maybe 20 years since I've seen this movie. I don't know about you, but
I would say it is. I didn't see it in the theater, so it wasn't in 89, but I rented it or saw it on HBO, like in the, you know, during the first sort of run of that. So I have not seen this movie since then. And yeah. And so I just remembered pieces of it.
Right.
Phil, when did you see it first?
So I was, and continue to be, but I was a very big Spielberg fan. And sort of as I was, you know, in the mid-90s, when I decided that I wanted to work in film in some form or another, and Spielberg became sort of my North Star, if you will, I watched all of his work for the most part. There's a couple of things here and there. But
like Dawson, like the character Dawson.
Like the character Dawson Leary on Dawson Street.
That's how I knew this film existed, because in the pilot of Dawson's Creek, he, you know, he has all the posters and he shows he's such a completist on the inside of his closet. He is always in 1941. Yeah. So those are always cemented in my brain as the embarrassing Spielberg films.
Yeah, it's
therefore I never bothered watching them.
Which is completely understandable. And listen, I'm not really going to ride for this movie, just to be abundantly clear. I'm probably going to defend it a little bit more than you guys, just because I imagine that I'm going to fight for, you know, Steven. But I'll say this. I saw it back in the day. I was probably 13, 14, 15 years old, something like that. And more than anything, I was just bored. Like, I didn't tap into the deeply misogynistic components of this film, and none of those things really spoke to me back then. Now watching it, my takeaway is that Spielberg knows how to shoot a very lovely movie, and Holly Hunter's great. Those are my two takeaways from this film.
John Goodman is great.
And exactly. It's a slight movie. It's a movie that I found myself when I watched it the other day thinking, we don't need this movie. Like, this movie is completely unnecessary. Like, when you look at his canon of films, and we're going to do our top 10 list at the end of the episode, when you look at Spielberg, like, why? Why this? Other than the fact that him and Richard Dreyfuss loved A Guy Named Joe, this fucking Spencer Tracy film that they liked as you know, as kids or whatever, there's no reason to make this movie. This movie has very little to say about anything.
Although, I will just, so we don't get too far away from what we were saying before, I would say that This is the most Dawson Leary of Spielberg movies. I feel like this is the movie that like both speaks most to Dawson's ethos. And I haven't watched that show in a really long time either, but I remember a big takeaway I remember from that is that like Dawson is obsessed with Spielberg, although nothing about him seemed to speak to that, except it would suggest that this movie was probably the one that most closely paralleled his worldview.
You know, it's also amazing. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, the Dawson. I'm so happy we got to Dawson's Creek
so quickly
because this was the frame of reference for me, and I want to go a little further on that. When Dawson, like you said, David, Dawson Leary in no way seemed like a Spielberg fan, right? But I would also point out that when that show came out in the mid-90s, even post-Jurassic Park, Spielberg wasn't cool.
No.
Like, it wasn't cool to be a Spielberg fan. It wasn't cool as a cool kid. It wasn't cool as a cinephile. It was still not. Well, I disagree with you. I think it is kind of cool now to be a Spielberg fan. Okay. But it's certainly, you know, it's not like being a Paul Thomas Anderson fan. It's not the same thing. Yeah. But at that time, he was the most commercial of the commercial. He was someone who I think got, you know, accused of making movies for McDonald's toys first and for the actual film second. Now, don't get me wrong. All incorrect and all wild misapprehension of what Spielberg does. But that's, you know, kind of not the point. Yeah. And always, so when you say, why did Spielberg make this movie? My sense is that Spielberg wanted to do something different. That wasn't explicitly for kids. That wasn't explicitly something that had a McDonald's tie-in. That was, you know, when you look it up on Wikipedia or on IMDb, the genre of this movie is the, you know, the very rare romantic drama. Yeah, you don't see a lot of unabashed romantic dramas. And I guess there's some comedy here, but the comedy is about, it's about as comedic as the Karen Allen stuff in Raiders. Like, you're not really pushing the comedy too hard in this movie.
Yep.
This is a romantic drama, very sincere, a bit of supernatural, a bit of a supernatural element that I do think like kind of plants it back in Spielberg's lane a little bit, but in general, like I do think that this was an attempt, a straight up attempt to make a movie for grownups, which I don't think he had really done.
Well, so two things come to mind. The first
maybe
is
Color Purple. Color Purple.
I just need to very quickly put a period at the end of the Dawson's Creek thread here, which is that one of the things that I love is that later in the series, Dawson, to show that he's changed, becomes a Soderbergh fan. And takes all of his Spielberg posters down and becomes, and I'm just like, you're not a Soderbergh fan either, by the way. Dawson Leary does not fit into either of those fucking
Let's
camps,
play the game.
But I do think that's
who is Dawson? Who, if you were rewriting that pilot in 1995 or whenever it came out, what's the right answer to that question?
It's also the idea that he's like the most like blonde haired square jawed. I'm replacing one Jewish filmmaker for another Jewish filmmaker because that's me. That's what I'm espousing.
And Soderbergh is like, I mean, he's an auteur for all intents and purposes. Crazy. But anyway, it's neither here nor
there. I understand the attempt at character development through which Jewish director you like. It's very hard because to your point, the sensibilities of who I would think a Dawson would like would either be someone like a John Hughes, which may even be a little too edgy for him, or someone like straight up like David Lean, like just something that's just like, or David O. Selznick, the magic of cinema, the scope, the epics, the feeling I felt when I first watched Gone with the Wind.
I think what it was trying to say, and you know, thank you for inviting me on your Dawson's Creek podcast. I think it was more like trying to convey the idea of like a high school age who would eventually be a film school brat, but written by writers who were obviously quite a bit older than Dawson is. And so it was trying to kind of capture a thing because truthfully, like in that era, if you're, you know, going to film school and looking at contemporary filmmakers, you know, you were looking at like a Tarantino or something like that. Yeah. And that show was trying to put a timelessness on it, something that didn't feel like of the second contemporary, which I think segues to Always, a movie that I constantly, while I was watching it, was like, when is this movie happening? And it is the present. There are a few references, Sort of to the present. I mean, they were watching a 10-year-old episode of SNL, but I think that's the closest thing that kind of places us in the time period. But it was like there were moments, and I'll like just jumping ahead where I was like, you know, because Holly Hunter is, you know, 30, 31 in there. And it's like, has Steven Spielberg ever met a person born in the, like, born later than him? Because like, yeah, like, the people in this movie were, I mean, their song is Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, which is the thing, actually, weirdly, one of the main things I remembered from this movie, because I don't know, my mother had a record collection, and that record collection was the American Graffiti soundtrack, which also has in it, and also has Smoke in Your Eyes in it. But like that, and they're listening to like Yakety Yak. Like there's nothing that indicates that anybody in this movie was born before Steven, you know, like that lived outside the 40s.
This is another kind of pet theory of mine, which is like, okay, that's all true. This movie takes place, I guess, in the 89, something to that effect. It feels like mid 80s, maybe late 70s, but the progression of culture, mm-hmm, from the early to mid 60s when those songs came out to the late 80s was light years ahead. If you put a song in a movie right now, like for instance, Longshot did with Roxette, that song is 30 years old. Yet I didn't listen to that and say those people are, you know, they those filmmakers didn't understand people, because that song still has a contemporariness to it that Smoke Gets in Your Eyes doesn't. Smoke Gets in Your Eyes is the title of the Mad Men pilot, right? Like that's when that song lives.
Well, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, actually, I mean, because this came in my research of, you know, because I watched A Guy Named Joe, and we'll get into that. Wow. And
it was on TCM yesterday.
Did you watch it or no?
No. You know why it was on TCM yesterday?
Because Joe Biden, all the movies are named Joe. Have Joe
named it? Oh, funny, yep. Funny.
Yeah, all these Joe movies that
have
happened.
But I would have to read Wikipedia. But I believe that the first sort of famous version of "Smoke Gets in Your Eyes" was recorded by Irene Dunne, who plays the Holly Hunter part, in 1935. Oh, so this is not. They play the Platters version over the credits, and J.D. Souther plays it in the bar. He's like an Eagles collaborator, but this is a movie that so far predates rock and roll. So this isn't even really a baby boomer cultural touchstone, which makes sense because, as we'll also get into, Richard Dreyfuss plays a 100-year-old man in this movie.
So I do think it needs to be said that, like, just to start at like the Spielberg of it all before we sort of get into the movie itself.
Yeah.
So the only thing that the only real connection I see between this film and previous Spielberg films is Empire of the Sun, his fascination with World War II planes. His father was a World War II pilot. I think there's a fascination there for him. I get that. But I don't, this film just ultimately, as I was watching it the other day, I was just like, this just doesn't really check any boxes that make any sense for him. But I mean, did you guys feel as though there was any Spielbergian kind of vibe to this?
I mean, I think it was the plane stuff. If you like kind of, I know when the documentary came out about his career and they kind of showed the movies he made as a child, like those movies, like he was very into like splicing he and his sisters or whatever in with like World War II plane footage. Mm-hmm. And I think that is also where A Guy Named Joe is compelling to him, because it's a movie that both has like a kind of a very like optimistic view of humanity, and then also is intercut with action sequences. So I think it has a lot of there's a few things in the sort of like elements to it, but it also felt like it felt like the script. The way the script was written, or even the way the dialogue was, the way there was something very heightened about it, didn't feel very him at all. But like it, there is a version of this movie that feels like it could at least fit in with like the kinds of things that he's really interested in.
Yeah. It's so It's written by Jerry Belson and Diane Thomas. Diane Thomas has a credit on this film, weirdly doesn't have a credit on the movie. Like when you watch the film, Jerry Belson has a sole credit.
Oh, yeah.
But Diane Thomas apparently did either an uncredited rewrite or a partially credited rewrite on it prior to her death. I wonder if the Diane Thomas, who did Romancing the Stone and became, and then unfortunately passed away at very young. There's a little bit of crackle in Dorinda that I see a little bit of kind of Romancing the Stone vibe there. But like, that's the only thing I can really sort of see her in.
I kind of want to start a little more elemental.
Sure, sure.
Then we're going, because I don't think that this movie necessarily had to be this bad. It's like,
I agree.
Like I said to you, Phil, this movie, more than any movie we've done in it, 99 or 89, is a masterclass in how to cast or how not to cast, right?
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So I understand and appreciate that Dreyfuss and Spielberg are old friends who kind of owe their career to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that when you get to that point with someone and you have a shared, you know, a shared admiration for a certain film or whatever, you work with them until the end.
Yep.
Richard Dreyfuss
All wrong.
Is not my favorite actor. Yeah. And Richard Dreyfuss in this role is a disaster.
Yep.
It's an absolute disaster.
It's a disaster. It's a disaster on so many levels, but the moment he was put in this movie, the movie was DOA. Then you cast Holly Hunter against him, who looks like his daughter. And it's even more DOA.
She's acting then circles around him. Like she's just like lit, like she, circles.
Yeah.
It's because she's such a better actor than he is. But like, he just is not in her league. Then you put on the other end, the other side of this love triangle, the Marlboro man, the literal Marlboro man who can't act. The man is incapable of delivering a line, but also is one of the most physically perfect humans who's ever lived, and is about 10 years younger than Holly Hunter. Yeah. So the whole thing looks beyond bizarre.
And isn't even close to a Richard Dreyfuss type.
In
A Guy Named Joe, which also has such like weird age things between the actors, but while they're different, they're very different ages. Van Johnson and Spencer Tracy are kind of physically similar looking men. Mm-hmm. Like their idea that a woman would fall for both of them, but the idea that like I'm kind of like my type is a Richard Dreyfuss type, and I'm now moving into somebody who would be sure to play Superman.
And then a step further on that is, you know, this is a modern viewpoint, but any idiot could have gotten this at any point. The last person in the entire world who needs help from beyond is the fucking Marlboro man.
Right.
Right? This guy walks into any room, he is the center of attention, and he's going to get every pass until he proves he cannot handle whatever is in front of him. So the whole thing, I'm of the opinion that this movie isn't so bad on the page. I'm of the opinion that this movie had the potential to really work.
I agree.
To me, no matter what, that last scene underwater is gold. Mm-hmm. Not with Richard Dreyfuss in it, but on the page. Yeah. Like, that's a really strong moment, potentially, where he's dead and there's a moment where she's kind of, like, in limbo and you actually see it. Like, the bones are there.
Oh, 100%.
It's this casting of these two men.
So go ahead, David.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, like, I'll talk a little bit about the few ways it could be different, but I want to go back. I don't want to go too much past the casting of Richard Dreyfuss, because I don't think it is just a matter of that they owe each other careers. I think I think for their first two collaborations is the fact that Richard Dreyfuss is playing a Spielberg avatar, that they're the same age. They're physically similar men, you know. Close Encounters feels like a very
certainly that one, yeah.
yeah, personal movie of like, you know, of a Steven Spielberg type becoming, you know, obsessed with things and how he sort of balances life stuff. And so that also, and very significantly, they never work with each other again. And I'm pretty sure I didn't.
You don't. Find this is the last time they worked together. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's also a matter of like, that to not cast Richard Dreyfuss in this movie, to for Spielberg to cast Richard Dreyfuss in the movie is a weird way of saying that this is a movie that felt like he had a personal connection to, which I also don't, or to that character, which I don't see. Mm-hmm.
Well, so what it's worth, just for what it's worth, I'm not saying that this is the right casting. This is the casting that he initially chased, which was Paul Newman and Robert Redford, and that he could not figure, they both wanted to play Pete, and they couldn't figure it out, and neither of them wanted to play Ted, and it fell apart. Now, I'm not saying that Paul Newman and Robert Redford and Holly Hunter in this film, and this film all of a sudden works. I don't think that's true. But it's a lot better than what it is.
Sure. Well,
the thing about Pete, yeah, the character of Pete, is that's a layup for almost any good actor. It's right. Just a layup.
Paul Newman could have done that in his sleep.
Because almost any leading man, yeah, it's a layup. Now, what I was thinking, you know, sometimes you have these, I can't think of an example, I'm sure you guys can, but sometimes you have these directors who are really big commercial directors with really big hits who go and make their smaller film or their more personal film, and they bring the leading man from those hits with them,
yeah,
to a smaller, more personal film. How this wasn't immediately offered to Harrison Ford, I don't understand. Because Harrison Ford is the obvious guy to play this role for me. And then you work from there. You know, if it were, yeah, Harrison Ford, I think I could start to understand what's going on here. But yeah, a world in which Richard Dreyfuss physically is one thing. Like, I can get past someone being, like, physically not right for the part, though it's hard. I'm not trying to say that, like, I'm above that. I'm far from it. But he's physically all wrong for the part, but he's dispositionally all wrong. He's smug,
yes,
asshole.
He's so fucking cocky in this movie. It's awful.
Anybody who, the idea that he would be a leader of men when he is such a smug asshole, yeah, throughout the whole movie doesn't fly for me.
Well, the thing that you're tapping into, my biggest issue with the movie is his possessive quality of Dorinda is so off-putting that every time he calls her his girl, or every time he says, you're never going to love anyone as much as you love me, like every time that he continues to sort of kick her deeper and deeper into grief and mental illness, I'm just like, what the fuck is wrong with this person? Like, it's really problematic for me.
Part of the reason I watched A Guy Named Joe is because I wanted to understand that there are some things that just so deeply don't work in this movie that is lifted directly from that movie. There's 100 things that don't work in this movie that aren't lifted from that movie. But, you know, in a weird way, it's like some of these things, some of these kind of ridiculous choices, if you watch the other movie, you will understand that it's referencing it. Okay. But when a movie set in 1943 has like, in World War II has like a Spencer Tracy, you know, saying you're my girl, it hits differently. It feels different.
Sure.
It's the time, and it's also she is, you know, like they also are a lot more like matched in their sort of tones and their toughness.
Yeah.
So it also doesn't feel like it is him trying to weaken her. You know, and the repetition of it in this movie is all building to the last line, which is the same last line in both movies. Okay. That's my girl and that's my boy. And that's my girl and that's my boy might be the worst moment of always, of many moments. I mean, it's
not good.
So gross. It's so vile. and A Guy Named Joe is not a flawless movie. It has a lot of problems with it, but that line worked great in that movie.
Yeah.
So I agree with all that, obviously. It is horrible and it's disgusting. There is a way. So this movie, to your point, Dave, because like I do think that I wish I had watched A Guy Named Joe, because it does seem like there are issues with this from the conception. The idea of somebody dying and then trying to get their girlfriend pawned off on someone else is kind of uncomfortable to begin with. An old fashioned idea that probably felt wrong then. So that is always going to be an issue. But there's got to be a way to do that kind of thing better. And I would propose, like, 1 year later, Ghost comes out, which is essentially the same setup.
For sure.
Less ridiculous, right? Like, it's to me, it's like, I think that the fundamental conceit of this movie, the idea that the thoughts in our head that we don't understand are just essentially ghosts telling us what's up, is so lame and, like, without any, it's no level of creativity to that. It's a lot more creative, the idea that Patrick Swayze can go inside of, you know,
Whoopi Goldberg's
body. That's dope. But not even that, like, the idea that there are mediums. Like, this is, like, the idea, like, that works a lot better for me. But either way, like, you know, mechanisms are mechanisms. I can get over a mechanism. But the ideas always should be about, like, the relationship is something that Patrick Swayze can't let go of. It's just about the two of them letting go, not Patrick Swayze putting her on another path. That's so weird and creepy. You're dead, bro.
I mean, this sort of, you mentioned earlier, David, this idea that, like, the film dips its toes into the supernatural but doesn't, like, really fully commit to it for all intents and purposes. Like, it does in the sense that we have this Audrey Hepburn character named Hap, who originally Spielberg wanted Sean Connery to play. Because this movie needed more dudes. Anyway, she was paid $1 million for the role, donated her entire salary to UNICEF, which is awesome. I mean, Audrey Hepburn's awesome. I don't have a problem with Audrey Hepburn. She's actually quite charming in these two scenes that she has in this film. She's Audrey Hepburn. Like, you can't, I mean, like, it's, she's untouchable. But,
but why does she give me a haircut? I mean, for those who haven't seen this movie, the first thing Richard Dreyfuss does is die with his normal Richard Dreyfuss hair, the same hair he's had in every movie his entire career.
And then she gives him a haircut.
And she gives him a haircut.
In the woods.
In the woods, in the beyond. You know, like, I mean, you know.
It's like a very sort of screenwriting thing of, like, give them a little business. Give them something.
Yeah. Or maybe our driver was like, you know, I need something to do with my hands. I can't just let me do something. This.
We don't just want a static scene of, like, two people talking. Like, give us
it's great. But she's lovely, even though she's saddled with basically all the exposition and has to, like, barf up all these rules and what his role is in this sort of in-between place that he's in, this purgatory
lovely
place.
Lovely barfing.
Lovely barfing of exposition. But essentially he dies and he finds out It's sort of unfinished business, but not. It's this idea that, like, he can't move on to heaven until he helps some guy bang his ex-girlfriend. I don't really understand.
It's not even, you know, to be generous to this movie, it's not really framed that way. I mean, essentially he's trying to teach him how to be a great pilot. And for that, we have to also by that Richard Dreyfuss is, like, the greatest pilot, which you know, which is a hard buy. And
I would not want to get my pilot lessons from a guy who crashed his last plane and died.
Yeah, for sure.
I know this guy's not the best at. Because there are like tens of thousands of flights a day.
Correct.
Like, none of them crash.
It's true. It's true.
He's probably one of the worst pilots ever.
He's also just, and you tweeted this, David, when I was tweeting about Always. Yeah. Like, yeah, Richard Dreyfuss isn't a guy that you're like, hotshot pilot? Hotshot firefighting pilot?
It is basically what you're asking with the, you know, it is a sort of a meditation on masculinity if the casting felt like it was. I mean, if it was a Paul Newman Robert Redford movie, then it is a little bit about like, you know, of understanding, you know, one's own, how one's own, like, need for you know, masculine, like bombasticness is like one's own downfall. Sure. But you are sort of casting Richard Dreyfuss as the maverick role. And that's like, it's lunacy. And,
yeah.
But it leads to what I think is another just flaw in this, which is that like the stakes of pilots who put out fires are not high enough. Like it is, I mean, obviously that is an important job, but there's a big difference between them being war pilots in the original and this being an important but not necessary gig that has built this like little community, but it just doesn't feel like there's nothing that feels like essential, like, you know, like the essential need that I must go up now. I can't stop this. It doesn't feel like the weight of the world. Mm-hmm. It feels like a little bit of like a side idea.
And I'll take it. Just kind of a side saddle of that idea to the point you just made is, unlike being a fighter pilot, there's no bloodlust involved. There's no room for someone who is going to take this in the wrong direction, start shooting towns, start shooting civilians, start doing things that are like bad and dangerous and whatever. If you're putting out forest fires, you're all good, right? Yeah. You're just a good guy. So I do think that I don't know if this premise lends itself to a deconstruction or analysis of masculinity out of control the way a wartime pilot might. I think the whole thing is kind of weird, but I think what it might lend itself to is the idea of a god complex. The idea of I could do everything. The idea of, you know,
well, there's certainly an invincibility. This invincibility that he feels like.
Yeah. Like these kind of things where you are above this massive, uncontrollable, wild thing. Mm-hmm. You have hundreds of people on the ground whose lives are, you know, at stake. Other firefighters, I mean. And you're the only one who can fix it from above. There is like this little god complexy thing that could maybe go on there, but that's not played with here. That's not
sure. Also, there's nothing that makes like you don't learn a lesson about not having a god complex by having the power to control people's minds.
No, you don't. It's not. It's. I just tried to think of what could be his fatal flaw potentially, but this, you know, and then you know, furthermore. To your point from the beginning, like, let's give the movie the benefit of the doubt. The goal wasn't go fuck my girlfriend. The goal was make this guy better, ..
Yeah.
Right? Right. And we could extrapolate that to me, make this guy a competent pilot or I presume like
a better pilot man.
Pilot as good as you were. Like, feel your role, I guess. Like, you're gone. You need to be there. But nothing about this guy makes no concept of why it's this guy, putting aside the way he looks, but there's no concept of why it's this guy that he needs to take care of.
Well, I totally agree. I don't mean to rewind very quickly, but the casting really is so paramount to everything you guys are talking about here. Like this, no offense to Brad Johnson. He is all wrong. He's not a particularly good actor. He doesn't make sense. He doesn't bring the right energy. You know, Tom Cruise was apparently offered the role. He turned it down. He would have been all wrong too, quite frankly. Like, it needed to... There's no one that was going to play next to Richard Dreyfuss that was going to make any fucking sense. So you kind of shot yourself in the foot when you cast Richard Dreyfuss, as you said earlier, Kenny. But... they really just did not find competence in the charm that's necessary in the Ted Baker role, because all of this stuff that we're talking about, all of this firefighting, all of this competence, all that sort of stuff, like, it's a side issue ultimately to the romance that's the beating heart of this thing. And if that's not working, none of it's fucking working.
Right.
The romance, and then again, the romance between whom, right? Like, you know, you have a romance that lasts about an act that is
up top. Yeah.
Awful. Everything about it is awful. Like, every moment is awful. The way they speak, the way The way Dreyfus speaks to her is awful. I do want to say the dialogue is not the problem.
Yeah.
The dialogue, there's charm in those words. It's the delivery that's the problem to me.
For sure.
But it's awful. I don't want these people to be together. I'm so happy when he died. I feel so happy for her. She doesn't even cry. She sits back and just chills and hugs, you know, puts her hand out for John Goodman. I'm like, that's the appropriate response.
Yeah, this guy who was always seemingly like he had a death wish and cared about you know, his death wish more than he cared about me. Fine, good riddance. Yeah,
it was a chapter. Chapter's closed.
I will say to your point, I'll underscore your point in saying that their chemistry doesn't work, and if that chemistry doesn't work, then when he dies, like all of these, it creates dominoes, right? Like he dies, and then it's like I don't feel anything for that, and then I will say that somehow Holly Hunter makes me care about her, but that's just because Holly Hunter's a great actor. And to your point, Kenny, her dialogue isn't particularly bad, but the character is just chopped off at the knees by having to be quote unquote obsessed with Richard Dreyfuss. Like it's very problematic.
Well, it's that. And then there's also the very like as if she's a character from The Newsroom, where she's also not very good at her job. As Richard Dreyfuss points out often, and then the whole movie hinges on this big third act twist where
she steals a plane,
even though it's been constantly set up that she is ill-equipped to do it. Now, in A Guy Named Joe, the reason that she does it is because it's a war and people die all the time. She has a sense that Spencer Tracy is going to die before he dies. And she has the same sense with her new boyfriend. Okay. So she can't let that happen. She basically steals the plane because it is an essential thing that needs to happen. She knows he's not going to come back. Mm-hmm. She's willing to risk her life for it. It is a thing that is sold by the fact that she has this intuition, which is pointed to a few times and always, where you see Richard Dreyfuss like bathed in blue light, you know, and you get some sort of like subtext that she thinks he's going to die, but there's nothing that overt. It is not the same thing with it is never conveyed in the same way with Brad Johnson that that if I don't do this, he's also never going to come back. Also, their relationship is not deep enough at that point. It comes in A Guy Named Joe. There's a bit more of time jumps, so they're already engaged at this point. And so this is like a great love of hers.
Let me just very quickly give a brief synopsis of this film for the people that haven't seen it. Aerial firefighter Pete, played by Richard Dreyfuss, risks himself and his vintage World War II airplane in a constant and death-defying quest to fight forest fighters, much to the dismay of his girlfriend Dorinda, played by Holly Hunter. His love for Dorinda and the advice of fellow pilot Al, played by John Goodman, convinces Pete to give up his perilous career, but he flies one last mission. Pete heroically saves Al's plane from certain destruction, but with supernatural consequences. All right. As I mentioned before, written by Jerry Belson and Diane Thomas, directed by Spielberg, it opened on December 22nd, 1989, in fifth place with $3.7 million against National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, Tango and Cash, The War of the Roses, and Back to the Future Part 2. It would go on to make $74 million worldwide, which is not great for a Spielberg film. Always has 64% on Rotten Tomatoes and 60% from audiences. I'll very quickly read a snippet from Ebert's two-star review. When Spielberg and Dreyfuss were making Jaws in 1974, they quoted individual shots from A Guy Named Joe starring Spencer Tracy to each other. And finally, in 1989, they got to make it themselves. The remake is called Always, and it takes place now instead of then, and the pilots are fighting forest fires instead of enemy planes, but the basic ideas are still in place. They do not, unfortunately, add up to much. This is Spielberg's weakest film since 1941. The film's most curious quality, given the fact that it was directed by Spielberg, is a lack of urgency. Even though the pilots are flying into the jaws of hell, they have an insouciance, a devil-may-care attitude that undermines the drama. The feeling of the film is more 1940s than 1980s, which is no doubt what Spielberg was hoping for, but I'm not sure it works. Some of the dialogue seems dated too, and a lot of the sounds written instead of spoken, as if these guys learned to talk by studying old pulp magazines. The result is a curiosity, a remake that wasn't remade enough.
Yeah, sure. It does, you know, I think it speaks to Kenny's point that the dialogue is not bad, but that yes, the delivery is very written. And I think even Holly Hunter does not overcome that. I think that she has the opportunity of like one, her and John Goodman with their sort of one scene where these like these two, but
they're great actors, yeah,
sort of they're facing good. Off. But also he screams at her in a completely unearned way. But it was like for a second, you're like, okay, that is this movie done in its best way with its best actors. But every other thing.
So I'm watching the film the other day and I'm thinking to myself, it starts and I mean, putting aside the fact that yes, Richard Dreyfuss and Holly Hunter do not have chemistry. Putting that aside, the first hour of the film didn't actually bother me that much. In terms of what's actually physically happening in the story, I was okay with it. You know, the opening scene feeling reminiscent of a Jaws sort of kind of moment. I liked, you know, the Wing and a Prayer birthday plane that Brad Johnson's character, the Ted Baker's, like there's a nice Spielbergian vibe to the setup of the film that didn't bother me so much. And like I said, I actually quite liked Audrey Hepburn as well. But it's after that, it's really kind of the rest of the film where, to your point, you know, we were talking about how actors delivering lines as though they're in a Pulp magazine. Like, Brad Johnson's never really been in a film before. He's basically the Marlboro Man, and he's just saying lines.
He was actually the Marlboro
Man. I know. He's acting like the Marlboro Man. Like, it feels like he's just like, well, this is what the Marlboro Man would sound like, right? If I was just him. It's very strange.
One of the big things that does not work in the after Richard Dreyfuss's dead part is that he's not talking to anybody. And it becomes what is like the biggest difference between this and Ghost. And actually one of the biggest differences between this and A Guy Named Joe, who there often are other ghosts around that he's like essentially the Audrey Hepburn part exists in multiple people in that movie and they're always around. So he has a chance to have dialogue. It is very, very awkward to watch somebody talk often over and over and over again and not really be heard and understood. Mm-hmm. And that is like, there's nothing to connect you there.
I want to say a couple things on that.
Yeah, please.
One, that's a very good point. That's that is a fundamental failure of this movie. I'm surprised that Spielberg or the writers of this movie didn't pick up on the position they were putting Dreyfuss's character in and putting the audience in as they were making the movie, because it is such a such an obvious mistake. Secondly, it may have worked better if it was a more charismatic, warm, compassionate actor. I want to ask you guys, I wanted to like this movie, period, right? I want to like every movie I see, but like I also kind of was like, you know, tickled at the idea of being like an Always fan when everyone says,
sure.
I thought that would be an exciting little thing for me.
Yeah, great affectation,
So I really did want to like it, and there's certain things I do like about it. I think it looks great. You know, it has a Rocketeer vibe, which you know, I don't love anything about the Rocketeer except the vibe, and therefore I really love that movie. You know, there's something about what the Rocketeer gives you when you're there that even though the movie's kind of ridiculous, I do really love that film. So I went into this, you know, certainly giving it every benefit of the doubt. And the first thing I wrote down, the first note I wrote down was, here's the problem. I hate Richard Dreyfuss. How do you guys feel about, and I there are plenty of Richard Dreyfuss movies I like. Love Jaws. Yeah. I think Mr. Holland's Opus works incredibly well.
Mm-hmm. And American Graffiti. I like him in American Graffiti.
Again, there are plenty of Richard Dreyfuss movies that work for me. I think he's great in the American President. But do you like Richard Dreyfuss as an actor in general?
I don't know if I have. Yeah, because those movies, yes, I like him in. I mean, he's weirdly better as an antagonist too, at least in his older age. I mean, there's also. There's something that just feels very, I mean, there's both the miscasting, but I was talking to Phil about this off mic, but the age difference is just, to me, he just seems so old. And he's 41, 42 here, which is shocking.
Because he's a baby. Obviously,
no, because he obviously looks like he is in his 70s. Yeah. And he has liver spots on his head. He is like fully gray.
It's been a hard life for Richard Dreyfuss.
He lived
a
hard life. The idea that, oh my
God. And he, it's, but it's the same. He and Holly Hunter are the same age difference as Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan in When Harry Met Sally. So it's like, it's there's, and never in that movie are you like thrown gross. By their age difference. So there's just something about him that feels gross. And I will say that I've not seen The Goodbye Girl. That's the movie he won his Oscar for. Right. I've not seen that. And maybe that is like worth seeing to like give him a proper evaluation. But like, he also, you know, he has a reputation of being a jerk, you know, and I think he acknowledges that too. And but he also comes off as a jerk.
Yeah.
So there are some actors who have reputations as jerks and they do, and it does not come off on screen. But there is like, but for somebody who can convey on screen that they were a pain in the ass to like craft services 7 minutes before, that is not something that you like, that you want in a movie star.
Yeah, so I want to off you what you were saying. Another thing that you're hitting on that for some reason we've just like, we've destroyed as a society. Not everybody looks their age. Therefore, it's okay sometimes for people to have actual age differences in the real world and play people who are closer in age in a show. Or in a or in a movie, for instance, I am now, but it's also true the opposite way, which is sometimes people are only 8 years apart and they look like they're 1,000 years apart.
Yep.
And the feeling you get is the feeling you get from this movie. And they're like, it's not okay because they're not that far apart. It doesn't make it okay because, you know, if you look at their IMDb's, they're only, they're like 12 years apart, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not okay because he really does look like his dad, or like her dad, and the feeling you get is like a creepy grandfather.
Yeah.
So for instance, I'm now watching 911 with my son every morning at 6 a.m. because he loves it. The Ryan Murphy show.
There's enough episodes to watch it every morning.
This happened. We're on our third. I am running so low on stuff to watch with this kid. We're now watching 911. He loves his favorite. One of the main couples is Angela Bassett and Rockman Dunbar, who was the guy from Prison Break. And he's been in a lot of stuff. I think he was in Sons of Anarchy. On screen, this is Angela Bassett. They look like they're the same age. In real life, she's 14 years older than him.
Yep.
Who fucking cares?
Yeah.
Right? If it works in the context of the piece, it works. And if it doesn't work in the context of the piece, like this movie, it doesn't matter that they're like both boomers. Like it's a disaster.
Well, can I ask this is a casting question, and you know, every one of us have been involved in casting in some form or another. I've never been in a situation that I can think of anyway where you don't get to do a chemistry read or you don't get to see some sort of a footage. Or I don't know if you've been in a situation like this, David, with any of the stuff you've worked on. But like this to me and a lot of these situations feel like, and it happens all the time in movies where you're just like, you got two big stars and they said they'll do it. So you just hope that when they're on the fucking stages together that they have chemistry and that it works. And this, to me, screams a little bit of that there was never any sort of audition process or anything.
There most certainly wasn't. And I've been in that. Yeah, like when you're at like the level where they're name actors. Mm-hmm. I mean, weirdly, I think Holly Hunter probably was still at a level where she had to audition for this movie.
I doubt it. It's 2 years after Broadcast News.
Fair. But no, I don't. I mean, I think that if like, there's a version where Richard Dreyfuss would have, like, where an actor would have wanted it, but I don't think Richard Dreyfuss would have done it.
Yeah.
So my sense is that, like, very possibly at the table read or barring that, like, the first day of on set is when they met. And
feels that way. It feels that way in the film, just in general.
Yeah, I think that there is an assumption that most actors at that level, and I mean, Holly Hunter wouldn't win her Oscar for what, four more years, but like these are Oscar-winning actors.
Yeah.
These are these guys are you know the creme de la creme, so to speak. It's an assumption that they both could have chemistry with a paper bag. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's crazy to just hire these people on the spot. But I do think this proves that, you know, it's just not the case always. Sometimes things just don't fit together.
I'm also just, if you bear with me for 1 second here, because I'm trying to see where Richard Dreyfuss is in his career at this point. I mean, he's... I mean,
this is it. This is the peak because I was like once he's off of this,
yeah.
it is a rapid decline.
It's like he got Tin Men and Stakeout, which are big movies. Let It Ride, which is also in 89. But like, it's got to be abundantly clear to people at this point that like, What do you do with a Richard Dreyfuss? Like he doesn't really fit into the mold of like a normal A-list movie star.
You that's good. You like it's good. No, it is like yeah. It's good. You do. What about Bob?
Like What About Bob is great. He's great in What About Bob.
You do movies where people recognize that this guy's a pain in the ass. You know, and then you have a personality to work with. Oh, by the way, the guy who should have played this character and would have fucking killed it, it doesn't have to be Harrison Ford, is Dustin Hoffman. Dustin Hoffman would have killed this role.
I guess I'm bumping against 5'4" Jewish men playing fighter pilots in all versions, but that's fair.
But if you're going in this direction of the 5'4" Jewish man, if you're not mandating that you need to have some gorgeous, you know, hunk,
yeah.
Dustin Hoffman played a very similar role in Outbreak and fucking killed it. Dustin Hoffman has this thing that Richard Dreyfuss doesn't have, where it's exactly what you said, David. Well known to be an asshole in his real life. Never brings that on screen. That's not his screen persona. Sure.
I think, he does. I mean, he plays the pain in the ass he is in Tootsie and does it great. But yeah. I think,
that movie.
I mean, ultimately.
Wait, we do podcasts like it's 1980.
1982.
Can we cover Tootsie? I think it's like in a different era, Richard Dreyfuss would then have like done a House of Cards. Like he would have had that like ability to transition. But I'm saying like if that existed in 1989,
yeah.
You know,
oh, sure.
where there was no longer a place for him as a movie star, but there was a place for him as an Oscar winning actor. And so
I think that happened, right? Like, I think, cause I think 80, what we're talking about is maybe we're just barely on the downslip of his bell curve, but we're still talking about, he's above the title and these are big movies. And when you told me you always made $74 million worldwide, like, this is an era where movies that made $35 million were considered hits. So this is that
this movie almost broke $100 million. Bad. Yeah, it's crazy.
I understand that's bad for Spielberg, but that's not bad for the world.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he makes Mr. Holland's Opus in 95 and is nominated for Best Actor. And I think deservedly so. I think that movie works really well. By like, I think like it was probably 98, 99. This is a guess. He makes The Education of Max Bickford. He recognized that it was over for him. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a CBS show.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that he did realize that the writing was on the wall, and the best I could do is try to make I think The Education of Max Bickford was an attempt to make one of these elevated network shows a la the David E. Kelly stuff that just didn't really work. But yeah, no, I think that I think he did try to figure it out.
Just to be clear, I don't dislike Richard Dreyfuss. I actually think he's done a bunch of really interesting films and a bunch of great performances. This to me just feels like Spielberg couldn't get any big A-list stars to do it, and it was kind of this pet project that him and Richard Dreyfuss had talked about for years, and so he kind of made it.
There's a movie called I don't know if you guys have seen it. Though it's not particularly obscure. Have you ever seen Brothers with Tobey Maguire?
Yeah, I saw it in the theater.
Yeah.
Jake Gyllenhaal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Natalie Portman.
Mm-hmm. And it's a love triangle, and it's, you know, Tobey Maguire is presumed dead, and now she's with his brother, Jake Gyllenhaal, and then Tobey comes back. And that movie is predicated on the idea that Tobey was the alpha, and Tobey is the big guy, and Tobey is like the one who's always kicked around his dumb little brother, Jake Gyllenhaal. And it has the same exact dynamic as this movie, and it's absurd. It is absurd. And there are just some roles that some actors are not able to play.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate. You know, you don't want to say that. You don't want to boil everything down to people's physical appearances, but that's quite important in the real world. It's quite important when you're actually casting movies. Mm-hmm. And Richard Dreyfuss just doesn't fly as a romantic lead, like as a matinee idol type romantic lead, sure. Which is what this movie calls.
You know, I also think that, you know, it's worth stating that, and we talked about this a little bit on the Last Crusade episode, but it's worth stating that Spielberg is a little lost in these years. The post Color Purple until Jurassic Park Schindler's List. He's got this, yes. You know, you got Last Crusade in there, and that's obviously a great movie. But like, you know, Empire of the Sun, Always, and Hook are three movies that people don't really talk about very much. Although there are people that love Hook, and I don't know, those people can love Hook. I guess I think that's
they have a childhood attachment.
Yeah,
to it,
sure, you know? Exactly. Hook is also the most glaring example of a movie that on paper should be a bona fide fucking success, and somehow just doesn't translate.
Phenomenal idea. Perfectly cast.
Perfectly cast. I don't think Hook is a disaster by any means, but it's not obviously what he is capable of, and we see it in the years that follow. But Always, to me, feels a little bit of him being like, it's like what you said, Kenny, this is a layup, right? Like, this is going to be great. Like, I'll do this nice romance about this, you know, and it's just the casting fucking killed it. And I really believe that same script, same director with two different actors, and this film goes up 10 points.
Phil, did you? I know you mentioned it on Twitter. Did you wind up watching Starman?
I did.
Starman has. Now, the Jeff Bridges character is nothing like this character, obviously.
Correct, yeah.
But it has a similar vibe. Mm-hmm. This romantic drama, essentially, takes place, you know, slightly within the realm of the supernatural.
Yeah.
And everything in that movie feels like it fits together really well.
Yep.
This could have maybe been like that with better casting and some of the script changes I think we've spoken about.
The irony is that Starman was a financial disaster and didn't make any money.
But it's an amazing movie.
Oh, it's an amazing movie.
Everyone's stupid.
I think it kind of got stuck in that weird undertow of post E.T. with all of the kind of like alien stuff that was kind of around, and I think people were just kind of done with alien stuff for a while. But absolutely, I mean, Jeff Bridges would have been great in this movie, quite honestly.
And I think it was very well. I think Starman was pretty well regarded, and Bridges was nominated. Yeah. I mean, was like, even if it didn't do well, like, look, you were compelled to watch Starman because you thought it was good. 40 years later,
nobody
in the universe is watching Always because they've heard it was good.
No. Everyone who's watching Always now is watching because they're doing a podcast.
Yes, that's right.
Podcast.
So I want to just talk about a moment that to me feels like exactly what the film is trying to.
Wait, just before we get into the actual stuff.
Okay.
How in a given month on iTunes?
Yes.
How many downloads do you think Always gets across the world?
Across the universe.
Across the universe. You think there are days that get zero, right?
10.
Oh, yeah. So most days get zero. Yes,
that's in a given in a given month. I would say there is like there's in the 10 to 50 range of people who are being Spielberg completists.
That's the only reason anyone would watch. I totally agree with you.
or somebody who was like you know like met Brad Johnson at a rest stop and he's like, hey.
Yeah.
Like weird stuff. Like for like a, you know, like just getting in a conversation. He's like, I was an actor. Like my first movie was a Spielberg movie. Everything else you wouldn't see, but it was like a weird thing that happened.
I texted David that we were going to do our top five Spielberg films. Originally it was going to be five. We bumped it to 10. And he replied, should we do our top five Brad Johnson films?
I love that this guy's real name is somehow blander than his character name, which is Ted Baker.
Brad Johnson, Ted Baker. It's like, fuck. So I want to just talk about the moment when Pete dies. Because to me, basically what happens is he saves fucking John Goodman by dumping water on his plane, blah, blah, blah. And then he somehow pulls himself out of this like terminal velocity dive and he levels out and there's a little flicker of fire on his engine and he kind of gives this playful shrug and then the plane just blows up. That moment feels like what Spielberg wanted the whole movie to feel like. And instead he got it once.
You know, there's a moment, and I think it's, and I don't know if I've referenced this on this podcast, but I reference it in my life all the time. I think it's season four of Friday Night Lights when Saracen starts apprenticing for the asshole artist.
Yes, that's season four.
The sculpture artist that he starts apprenticing for. And Saracen is a sketch artist. And Saracen does this really elaborate sketch, And the sculpture artist rips the whole thing up. And he gives him back the hand that Saracen drew of this person. And he says, this is the only part that doesn't make me want to puke. Make the whole thing out of this, the whole thing this part, right? So that's what that moment reminds you of. If 100%. You can take what he had at that moment and expand it to the whole movie, that does have the playfulness and the there's that moment and the moment underwater where I felt like, you could have had some.
I mean, I would even go as far as to say that the whole portion at the end when he's helping her fly, that whole stuff works. It's just, first of all, it has to do with just modulation of Richard Dreyfuss. And there just doesn't really seem to be any. Like, he's just kind of let off the chain to do whatever Richard Dreyfuss shit he wants to do. And
when you get Dreyfuss, that's what you do.
So it's like, what's great about that moment before he dies is it's silent. It's not him being some cocky prick or whatever. And there's a humility to it, and it's shocking. Like, the explosion is shocking, and it makes you go like, oh, I missed that guy, or whatever the case might be. There's also the John Goodman. the John Goodman kind of one motion of pulling off his sunglasses and putting his hand on the window is a nice, like, it's a great moment kind of overall.
Sure, yeah.
But it's just, it's emblematic of just how hard this movie is to do in 89. It's impossible to do today. But in 89, I even think that audiences were just a little too jaded and a little too wise for something that was this sort of old-timey and nostalgic in a way that didn't feel progressive. I don't know.
At least not in the old, not in the way that felt like such a throwback.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's because, you know, seemingly Ghost was probably shot at the exact same time. You know, it's something fascinating that, like, the ideas in the ether and Ghost, you know, which I probably haven't rewatched a few years, so I don't know if it all holds up, but it's like, it feels very much a 1990 movie. It doesn't, there's nothing about it that even though that, like, there's something so, there's something so, like, such a reflection between the repetition of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and the repetition of Unchained Melodies, both songs that kind of have a similar vibe to them and also feel like so old timey, but, like, there's nothing about Ghost that feels like it's a 40s
movie. What's funny, I rewatched Ghost, I want to say within the last, like, 4 months, my roommate, who's 10 years younger than me, had never seen it before. And I was like, you have to see Ghost. And she's like, why? I was like, well, I think it was a really big fucking movie. It made a lot of money. Oscars. Like, it's a movie. You should see it. And she's like, okay.
Kidding?
So we watch Ghost. She hates it. Like, she's just like, this, why was this ever a hit? I don't understand.
Why did she hate it?
I think part of it's a generational thing to some degree. But part of it, I think, has to do with, like, the Patrick Swayze, Demi Moore component too, which is like, those, they were stars, right? Like, these were people that, like, and it's the iconography of that film speaks to us more. Like, she'd never seen the vase scene. So, like, when she saw that, she was just like, this is kind of gross and weird and I don't really get this. Like, it's just, without context.
Which one?
What?
Well, there's two of them,
And they're very different.
The Unchained Melody scene.
No, there are two with Unchained Melody scene. There's one where it's before he dies.
That's the one I'm talking about.
When it's his body. Yes. And there's one where it's after he's dead, where he has gotten inside of Whoopi Goldberg's body. Now, like,
but that's not with the vase. I said with the vase. I'm talking about the clay vase sex scene.
David, help me out here.
I'm remembering there's one when he's a ghost. I might not be with Whoopi, but I mean,
No.
Phil has seen it.
They don't show it as Whoopi. That's the point. They show it as Patrick Swayze's body. But if you take 2 seconds to think about what's happening, he has gone inside her body and she says, "You can use me."
Yeah, but they're not doing the vase in that scene, is the point I'm trying to make. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Yes, they are.
I've literally seen the movie 4 months ago.
It's a Mandela effect thing.
It doesn't matter.
It's a Mandela effect. Do they dance? What do they do?
They danced, don't they?
No, the music plays. He gets in her body and they kiss.
Oh.
But the kiss you see is between her and Swayze, not between her and
Whoopi. No, I know that. I'll go back. Maybe it is a Mandela effect thing.
My point being, more than anything, I hope it really is Whoopi. I agree with you 100%, David, that the leap that happens between Always and Ghost works because all of those other puzzle pieces are kind of working. Ghost is also, like, quite frankly, like, sillier and kind of acknowledges its sort of silly rules and
sure
all that kind of stuff. This movie is very earnest and Ghost is almost
so is
campy.
Ghost. Well, I will not stand here for Ghost blasphemy.
But Whoopi is a comic character.
Correct.
On purpose, right?
No, I know. Yeah. But that meant to undercut.
Yes, very much so, because it knows what it's doing.
Correct.
Ghost is unabashedly romantic between the leads. And the
ditto.
Scene is
ditto.
Incredible. Ditto is romantic.
I'm not disagreeing.
I know. But that's actually something I thought of throughout the movie. Right. I thought of throughout this thing, mm-hmm. that these characters didn't have something.
I agree.
They didn't have something that was theirs, except maybe Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, but like a song. Like Ditto was so perfect because it did two things. One, it was something that only they knew. And two, it said something very specific about Patrick Swayze's character, which is he never opened up to her when he was alive.
Well, there are two things in Always that didn't work, obviously, but they did have a few things. One was a weird thing that I don't think was in A Guy Named Joe, and I don't think they even really paid it off. But at the very end, before he dies, when he's yelling, "I love you," also like "I love you too,"
but you can't hear it over the propellers. The engine, yeah.
You think that it's setting up a ghost moment where he mm-hmm. never says "I love you," but it really doesn't pay off. And there's another thing that is in A Guy Named Joe. It makes more sense in A Guy Named Joe, where he plays with his eyebrows a lot. And then Brad Johnson starts doing that. But that's it. That's all they have.
I don't know exactly what that means, but yes.
the eyebrows, you mean?
It's just a weird gesture that only he does.
No, I get that. I do that. I don't because he's not inhabiting his body or correct. Something like that, where he's just, you know, he's just saying things into his head. It doesn't mean anything.
I agree. I'll say this too. I feel like the powers that Richard Dreyfuss has, and by that I mean there's this weird moment when at the beginning, when he's a ghost, he walks up to some like janitor and like makes fun of him and says he's really ugly. And then the janitor gets really sad. And I'm just like, what the fuck is this? Like, you're using your powers to depress people, like, and make them feel shitty about themselves. It was these type of things that, to everyone's point, in a charismatic man, if Paul Newman did that, I'd be like, oh, Paul, you're just Paul Newman, and you're just being what. This, I'm just like, fuck you, Richard Dreyfuss. It just doesn't work for me.
He says he looks like a real silly guy.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. So then, there's then this moment where like, there's like a fucking malfunctioning truck that says "Follow me" that crashes into Dorinda's house, and that's how Ted and her cross paths again. Is this triggering a bell at all? Anyway,
yes, I remember this. Yes,
this happens.
The truck that is operated by Mark Helgenberger, the first most incompetent woman in the movie.
Correct.
Holly Hunter has the distinction of being the second most incompetent woman in the movie.
So Mark Helgenberger's in there for a second, and like it's very, it's like it's like someone gave her completely the wrong note on who her character is.
She's like, just being like flirty. That's just her only
thing. As if they told they like have a meet cute. It's as if they were like, you are going to be the romantic lead of this movie with Brad Johnson. And then they like never told her they changed the script.
Right.
Well, totally.
She's immediately in love with him. She's a completely charismatic, beautiful actress. And then and it's somebody, much like Brad Johnson should have been cast as somebody who didn't lead with, who we could accept needed to like gain confidence to woo somebody. Mm-hmm. You also, the confusing thing about both of these two people being beautiful that you're just like, they should just get together. The movie should end.
And that being said, Brad Johnson, not the best. He has better chemistry with Holly Hunter than Richard Dreyfuss does.
Oh, for sure.
The scene with the John Wayne stuff.
Yes.
When he's just being himself is the closest that anybody has chemistry with anybody else in this movie.
Is that before he saves the guy on the side of the road with the heart attack?
That is before. Yes. That is on that drive.
There's a scene earlier that also really annoyed me, which is the first scene with Ted and Al. Ted goes into Al's office with his hands covered in oil. Anyone's guess as to why. He then shakes his hand.
Oh, God. So
and you're just
like, oil.
But why did you do... Your hands are dirty. You know that they're dirty. It creates a whole bunch of shtick with, John Goodman rubbing his face with oil and Pete laughing at him from the great beyond and all this sort of shit. And it was like... All of it just felt so, this isn't working. And I don't know why anybody, Spielberg's got to be a video village being like, this is gold. Like, what? I just don't get it.
I'm so glad I can become a supernatural being so that I can prank my friend.
I could shtick him. You know what's funny? You guys do know who directed Ghost, right?
Yeah, it's...
Zucker, one Zucker, of the Zucker. David Zucker?
King of shtick. But there's almost no shtick in that movie.
That's
whereas
correct.
Spielberg... goes through all this slapsticky stuff for no reason.
So then Ted crashes into Dorinda's house and him and Dorinda have kind of a little bit of chemistry. And then right as Dorinda's about to sort of feel good about herself that she kind of flirted with another man, Pete whispers in her ear, "Don't forget you're still my girl," just to bring her back down to level.
Really?
Just make sure that she doesn't ever get over you.
As an aside,
did you notice that Richard Dreyfuss pronounces Dorinda different than anyone else in the movie?
He just says Rinda.
Dorinda.
It's almost like Phil, it's like he had a blank check with this movie. It's one of those things.
It did.
It's almost like not to get totally off topic, guys.
Mm.
But how fucking crazy was it that Soda Sotomayor mispronounced Kamala's name yesterday?
not to get off topic.
No, it just made me think about Sonia Sotomayor has a blank check.
Oh, for sure.
She did not think that maybe I should make sure that I'm pronouncing this unusual name correctly. As a person who's probably spent her entire life having her name mispronounced.
But the best part was Kamala's face and then her attempt to try to kind of correct her a little bit when she said her name back. But it's great. It's great stuff.
So the only connection is when you have that kind of power, if you're a Supreme Court justice or if you're Richard Dreyfuss, you can just do whatever the fuck you want. And
if
no
you're
one's
Richard
correct
Dreyfuss
you.
And right. always yes. you can yeah. say there's whatever you want. So Dorinda then, we don't need to get into the whole fucking machinations of plot because it doesn't really make any sense. But ultimately, there's a bunch of firefighters that are trapped in a fire and she needs to go, John Goodman's putting together a team to go and save these guys. But Dorinda takes the plane on her own, which... Here's what I kind of wish happened a little bit more, which is that they're doing this dance of is Dorinda suicidal or not? Is this just her way of is she trying to save these guys and willing to sacrifice her life to do it? Is she doing it because she needs to prove something to herself? And then when it crashes and she's in the water and she doesn't get out of the plane, you're certainly left to feel like she wants to die. So there's just a lot of mixed messages going on in the rationale.
As soon as she knew that dying means she'd have to see Richard Dreyfuss again, she wanted to
live. She's fuck it. We're at the surface.
That was it.
But do you know what I'm saying? I wish that when she gets in that plane, I'm I understand that this is based on emotion and it's illogical and they just want us to run with the heart of it. But it's also that they just really want these scenes with him and her.
They do. And it's like, I don't know if it would be better if they'd, established some, they sort of established something where he thinks she is a worse pilot than she believes she is, but it does not seem to be what drives her. Yep. We so rarely see her fly. Mm-hmm. I don't really quite know what her job is beyond that she is like, you know, is the sort of the
air traffic controller kind of
air traffic controller person. Yeah. So it isn't like, oh, everyone underestimates me. I'm great, because when she gets in the plane, you also realize that she also isn't a very good pilot. So it's,
And she gets in the plane at the beginning too, as like a fuck you to Dreyfus, because he flies in on a low tank of gas. Yeah. She gets worried and she's like, I'm going to show you. So she gets in a plane, flies really poorly to try to scare him, I guess. So he feels the way she felt. Well, but this doesn't tie to the end.
It's horrible. It's a disaster. It doesn't. It's like she's the backup pilot. It's like she's always there, ready to go.
Yep. Yep.
She's like the understudy pilot who never gets the gig. But like you know, another movie would say, well, you know, you're there because of, there's a glass ceiling, and you're actually the best. It's a very weird way to go. She reminds me a little bit of like, in West Side Story, how in the Jets there's that one girl who hangs out with them. Mm-hmm. Who's just kind of like the tough girl, but like, you know, she's not really, she's kind of like off the side, like, I can fight too.
Yep.
That's kind of the vibe I get from her. She's probably the worst fighter in the Jets.
There's a strange thing in the early scene where it's not her birthday party, as they have this weird thing where he got her birthday party wrong, where it's like every man is obsessed with her and everyone wants to dance with her, which I guess in some way, I guess is a way to convey like she is also the only woman, but then she isn't. There are also other women in the bar.
I hated every element of that scene.
That scene I hated.
Was that in My Name Is Joe or that,
well, yeah,
a,
well, the, yes,
a bro called Joe.
No, the only thing that was insane for me in that scene that wasn't a guy named Joe is that the gift he gives her is a dress and shoes. But the reason he gives her a dress and shoes and a guy named Joe is they're at war and he found a way to be in London and bought her something nice. But in this, it's just that Richard Dreyfuss, like the idea that anyone would buy their romantic partner a dress, like just wing it, just be like, she would like this. This would fit her well. Here's some shoes for her. It is an insane gift.
Well, I'm going to sound like I'm contradicting you, but I'm not. There's no such thing as an insane gift in a vacuum. Right. The circumstances around this are completely insane. This is the same gift that Woody Harrelson gives Rosie Perez in White Men Can't Jump, which is as romantic as things get, because she needed a good dress to go on Jeopardy. They had no money. He had just won a lot of money. He spent it all on her so she could be appropriate to go for her dream. Like, that's really sweet. In this movie, I don't even know what they're saying, because she kept saying girl clothes.
Well, because she's a tomboy, I guess. I don't know.
What is that? That's by choice.
But she's a tomboy who likes a dress.
I know. Yeah. If you're a tomboy, I know that you choose to be a tomboy, or maybe society has foisted that role upon you, but Richard Dreyfuss doesn't need a special occasion to say, do you want to try something else?
I agree.
And then the way she comes down in the dress in the middle of this bar around all these, like, you know, soot-covered men.
You get some serious Spielberg angles, too, of people, like, standing up into frame, looking wide-eyed they're seeing fucking E.T.
I know. It's like Karen Allen stuff. It's like, I get that you shot in a bar with two levels before, but you don't have to do all these same shots. But, it's the way they pass her around, like...
Well, I'll go and start before that. Which is,
it's like snowball with her, but with one person.
Well, there's this horrible moment
that's not a Kevin Smith snowball. It's a different.
I understand. There's a moment where all these guys want to dance with her, and she's like, "If you're gonna dance with me, you have to wash your hands." So Richard Dreyfuss is standing in the bathroom with his arms out with all these towels so that all these guys can wash their hands. And he starts talking in an Italian accent. He's like, you want to dance with my girl, you got to wash your hands. I'm just like, who thought this was a good idea at any point? This joke is bad. It's offensive. And then, like, they all get to dance.
No, also, and also, nobody, you know, someone who is so possessive, like Richard Dreyfuss, it's also so out of character.
Yeah. Speaking it's bizarre, because it's not. I mean, the Italian stereotype, like, it's stupid.
Yeah.
The offensive part is that he's pimping her out.
Of course. Like, it's but so it's crazy. Two levels of offensive.
Yeah. Oh, and he's so. Oh, he's like that again. Like, there might be a world. There might be. I'm not saying I could think of it. There might be a world in which that idea on the paper, I'm sorry, on the page, didn't seem so revolting, but in
the execution, I mean, it also highlights your point, David, which is that Richard Dreyfuss looks like a hobbit in that scene with all of these firefighters that are literally like a foot taller than him. So he just looks ridiculous. But speaking of possessive, this is where I really got angry at the film, which is at the very end, Pete gives this speech to her where he's like, I'm going to let you have a wonderful life now. I'm releasing you from my, I'm releasing your heart. I'm giving you permission to be a fucking person. And I was just like, you have to be fucking kidding me right now. Like, I just, that was when I was like, I'm done.
I know. And that's the difference between that Ghost is Ghost was like, I'm going to save you from a rapist who's going to try to kill you. And then I'm going to go to heaven.
And she gets to see him go to heaven. And like, I don't know. It just, and it's Demi Moore with her one tear. It's just like, you know, and she's
right. Right. And it's, and you also buy that Demi Moore is more broken up about it.
Woefully depressed.
Because she had real chemistry.
I love Demi Moore very much. Demi Moore is not Holly Hunter, right? Like,
different energies.
Holly Hunter's batting Holly Hunter, I don't really know the analogies, but.
Well, Holly Hunter saves this movie is the thing. Like, this movie is only, if this movie's good at all, and I'm not convinced it is, but if this movie's good at all, it's because of Holly Hunter. Whereas Demi is working with a bunch of really talented people. And
I think it's only relevant because when we texted about this, Phil, I think it was like an hour and a half in front of you. I'm watching this film and I said, the casting is terrible. And you said you hadn't seen anything. You said, in my opinion, Holly Hunter could do no wrong. And I said, this movie really puts that theory to the test. Yeah. Because the only reason to see this movie is to just see almost like an experiment, what an actor of Holly Hunter's caliber can do with this kind of material. And with everyone else around her playing the worst versions of themselves. So being the worst versions of their professional selves, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
She does a little wrong. I mean, there are moments that, there is no way that she could sell that scene where she pretends to cook. Where for the next scene, there is a crime scene on her wall where she is just like throwing food at the wall.
It's great. So I want to just highlight one other thing before we rate this. And it's kind of, it's a whatever, but I still wanted to highlight it. There's a shot at the end of this movie that I adore, which is the reflection of Dorinda in all of the various instrument panel on the plane as it's about to crash and do this sort of water landing. Mikhail Solomon shot this film. It's the only film of Spielberg's that he ever shot. He went on to become a director himself. He shot this and The Abyss in 89. The Abyss also, I mean, would love to. There's got to be some stories from that one.
We're going to get there.
We're going to get there for sure. Yeah. This is one of those films that, you know, Spielberg has a style. Spielberg has a look. There's no question. 93, he starts working with
Janusz
Kaminski, and it's Janusz forever. Like, everything else is just Janusz. So it's interesting in this period to see him using different DPs, sort of having some fun with playing with lenses, playing with his sort of visual style. But all that being said, it's not a good movie. Let's just rate it so we can talk about our top Spielberg films. You go first, Kenny. I'll let you go first.
Well, all right. So I you know what? I didn't know how this podcast was going to go. And I did kind of leave this with kind of a good taste in my mouth.
Okay.
All things considered.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I kind of expect, David, I didn't know what to expect out of you. I thought you might have liked it because you picked it. Phil, I thought you might have liked it because you kind of intimated that you liked it. And I was prepared to say that this movie is a 45, which is what I gave it. Okay. And what I wrote was, it really could have been much better. Ghost hit all of these notes, but the cast was perfect and the choices were awesome. And I feel like if you give this movie a grade above 50, it's almost it's almost a misunderstanding of what Ghost did so well. Like a movie that makes all the right moves versus a movie that makes all the wrong moves, even though it's directed by Spielberg. And I think Spielberg makes extremely watchable movies. I wasn't bored during this movie. And there was some stuff that was great. Like just stuff that's just clearly great. After this podcast and having it watched, you know, having talked about it with two people who were totally ready to shit on it with me and really just really get into the nuts and bolts of why I think this is not a good movie, I'm going to drop it quite a bit. I'm going to drop it to a 33. I think it's a bad movie. I don't think it's like a terrible movie. I do think it's quite possible it will be the worst movie we do at 89. But that partially is because we're choosing mostly the great movies.
I mean, we haven't done Pink Cadillac yet, Kenny. You don't know.
I'm looking forward to Pink Cadillac. but yeah, I think it's a pretty bad movie. I just want to almost reiterate this idea of like, just because it's Spielberg, just because it looks nice, just because like a lot of the things are in the right place.
Sure. Sure.
Like, the score is good and it's well shot. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make for a good movie. And it really is not a good movie.
That's well, okay. I saw this around, like I mentioned, probably in the early mid 90s. And I liked it fine, but again, I wasn't, you know, I didn't have the most discerning of eyes. I probably would have given it like a 65 back then. Like, didn't hate it, didn't love it, didn't leave much of a taste in my mouth, just kind of moved on with my life. Watching it the other day, I have to kind of, there is a push and pull of grading this as a film and then grading this within the Patreon of Spielberg films. Because as far as I'm concerned, as a Spielberg film, it's definitely bottom tier Spielberg. I'm not sitting here and saying that it's not. But I also would say that like I will never watch The Terminal or BFG ever again. Those movies are dog shit. I really don't like those movies. This movie... That's true. Has something going for it. It does have a very charming performance from Holly Hunter in it. It does have, as you said, score. John Goodman's very good in this film. Is it a great film? Absolutely not. Is it an absolute abomination? No. So where I stand, I'm at a 55. I'm barely recommending this movie. I'm not saying that this movie is a movie that you should run out and see. But if you're coming at me and saying, should I watch The Terminal, BFG, or Always? I'm going to say watch fucking Always.
But all three of them could be worse than 50. I mean, I understand that. I agree with you. I think BFG is one of the worst experiences you could have in the movie theater. But that's not, I don't know. That's not the end of the day. Like, you're not saying, is it better than his worst two movies? You're saying it's better than 50% of the movies.
I don't like this movie. I was angry at this movie. I didn't like the end of this film. I have problems with this film. I can't bring myself to say don't watch a Spielberg film because even a bad Spielberg film is better than most, is my point.
Fair. David. I could live with that.
Okay, so my memory of this movie, which is vague because it's, you know, because it's, you know, 30-something years ago and because I'm... 22 now. I mean, I saw it, but like my memory of this movie was a lot more fun. And why I picked this movie less because I remembered it fondly because I don't remember it very well, but I think it is actually the kind of thing that I would be interested in writing. Like if somebody had approached, these are the kinds of themes I'm very interested in. If someone had approached me to remake A Guy Named Joe, I like that would be, you know, probably more than other Spielberg movies I like better. So probably coming into this, I assumed it would live around, are we doing a scale of 1 to 99 or 89?
Yeah, 1 to 99.
99.
Okay, so I probably have, in my memory, it existed in the 60-something range. After watching it, I probably put it in the 30s, like in the 32, 35. And then between this, watching this podcast and then and watching a guy named Joe, and a guy named Joe I would still probably put around 60. I don't think it's an amazing movie, but it showed, but it ended well, and it hit it showed all of the things that could have been done better. Mm-hmm. So I think now I drop this down to like a 22.
Woo. All right. Well, I mean, it's a bad movie, guys.
And I haven't seen BFG. And I haven't seen 1941, but I would put this. I can't think of a Spielberg movie I enjoy less than this.
Really? Do you like The Terminal more than this?
I think a little bit more than this. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
I'm gonna use the restroom.
And then we'll do the top tens. Yeah. The Terminal, really, David?
I mean, I only saw it once.
The Terminal is offensive. Like, it's
The Terminal is a terrible ending, but there's moments of The Terminal that I liked more than this. So
it feels like, I think the thing that really stays with me, the stench of The Terminal that stays with me, is the Tom Hanks sort of Eastern European funny accent Borat meets, like, I don't even know what. Like, it's just, there's this very kind of, it's almost like Lutka from Taxi. Like, there's just this, like, he's doing a thing that I'm just like, I don't like this. And you're not a real person and this isn't working. It just bothered me.
I mean, I'm not going to defend The Terminal because literally I've watched it one time and had a bad taste in my mouth. But in my memory of it, it was more that I kept expecting it to come together in the end, and it didn't. There were parts of it where I was sort of on the side of the movie. When I heard I would say that as a concept, I like the concept of The Terminal.
I get that. No, I agree. And listen, I'm not, my point more than anything is that, like, as I said at the end earlier, like, bad Spielberg's even is still better than most films that come out. I just purely on sort of a technical filmmaking perspective and casting, like, he gets good people, he gets the best people for all intents and purposes. So you're gonna, you know, it's gonna be worth watching to some degree or another. The Terminal, just, yeah, you should watch BFG someday, man. If you're looking for something to really just.
I gotta say, I'm not really looking for something to upset me as a bad movie.
I get that.
Love the book. I love the book.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, do you think that if this was Spielberg's first movie, if Always was Spielberg's first movie, he would have been allowed to make a second?
I mean, this is part of the kind of the mythologizing of Spielberg that I do think is interesting. I mean, if you look at sort of the TV shit that he did, putting that aside, but it's like, you know, he does Duel, but then he follows that up with Sugarland Express, which is really, no one likes it. It doesn't do very well. In hindsight, it's actually a pretty decent film. But, like, it's amazing that he gets to make Jaws. Like,
but because it's a small movie and it's not showy, Sugarland Express. It's like easy to, it's easy to, even, you know, even though, like, Heart 8 is a good movie, it's easy to remember, to forget that was P.T. Anderson's first
100%. Movie. Right. So it's like Duel and Sugarland Express, you kind of toss away. And then it's like, then it's Jaws, and then it's like game on. But, like, I do think that, if Always was one of his early films, I mean, the other thing that I think is interesting that I didn't mention when we were talking earlier, there's no record of what the budget of this film is, which I think is interesting. The reason being that I think it might have cost almost as much as it made. I could be wrong.
Sure.
That's a lot.
So anyway,
it looked expensive. I mean, it did not.
Those fucking planes. Like, yeah, it looked great.
It did not look like a cheap movie. Yeah.
Top 10 Spielberg films. Let's start at number 10. I'll do my 10, and then we'll go around, do our 10s, our 9s, our 8s, and kind of around like that.
I love doing this. All right.
So my number 10 is The Post. I love The Post. I think it's a great movie. I think it's an underrated movie. I wish I could cut off the last 2 minutes of it, but be that as it may, I just pretend like the movie ends when they're walking out of the printing, and it's all fine, and we don't have to hear the bullshit at the Watergate Hotel. I think it's a great film. You know, obviously we've had Liz Hannah on a couple times, but that's not why I'm putting it at number 10. I love it. I've watched it a bunch of times and it holds up for me. What's your number 10?
Well, I had an honorable mention number 11 that I'll which is The Pilot of Columbo is my honorable mention number 11, but we can, I do think, because I watched it in quarantine, and it is like an excellent pilot. But my number 10 is Bridge of Spies.
Nice.
Which is a divisive choice, but it hits I really like it, and it just hits a lot of things that I really love. I love Cold War stuff. I love spy stuff. I think it's a really elegantly made movie. And
Kenny loves Cold War stuff. Feels very and loves spies.
I'm okay with. Well, I don't really love. You're right. I don't like Cold War.
But it's interesting, David, that you bring up Bridge of Spies, because it does feel like that was a film that, I mean, critics liked it. It did pretty well. It kind of just existed. Why can't I think of the actor's name who won Best Supporting Actor for it?
Mark Rylance.
The BFG himself. Yes. It's one of those movies that
Ready Player One
that kind of doesn't exist in a weird way. Like, I think that's a film that 20 years from now is going to get reappraised, and everyone's going to be like, "Why did we sleep on this movie?" But anyway.
Yeah.
A couple of things I need to preface before we get into this on my list. One, I did not include Schindler's List. Just kind of seemed ridiculous to me. No offense if you guys did it.
I did.
It just seems like I figured you would, but I don't know. I don't like putting movies above it.
I'll talk about why I did, and I get your point, but I'll talk about why I did when I get to it.
As will I.
I Schindler's List is one of the best films ever made. You can put it number one on my list, but I didn't think that was fun. So I know I do. I think it's beyond words. It's not like it's not a movie like everything else we've ever seen.
I get that.
You know. So that's one. Two. I've never, as I said to Phil, I've never seen a few movies that I think could be on this list, and Bridge of Spies is one of them. Duel is one of them, and most embarrassingly is Lincoln, which I've never seen.
I think Duel, I've seen all of those. I think Duel as an artifact from a time and in a way that a director broke through is impressive. It is not, you know, it would not make your top 10.
Oh,
and
Amistad, I've never seen. There were four that I had never seen.
So. And Lincoln is what you think it is, which is both good and bad. And as is Amistad.
I'm assuming Lincoln is on at least one of your lists. So we will talk about Lincoln, I'm guessing.
Phil. It is not.
But neither of you put Lincoln on your list?
No. Nope.
So Lincoln, it's so funny because Lincoln.
It was almost 10. Almost 10. But it's
Screen Drafts podcast I love did a American President podcast. Mm-hmm. And number one, not to spoil it, was Lincoln. And they were unanimous in Lincoln is the best movie about the American presidency.
I think Lincoln's a great movie.
Hang on one second. Vulture just did a list as well, the 20 greatest movies about the American presidency, and Lincoln was number one. Mm-hmm. And Nixon was number two, and then the rest of them suck. But I do feel like, at least for me and what I'm consuming, Lincoln is kind of like screaming at me, watch this film. Okay. My number 10, Raiders of the Lost Ark. We did a whole episode on Last Crusade.
Low.
That is low.
Raiders is my second favorite Indiana Jones movie, as listeners of this podcast know. And I got to tell you guys, like, the fact that you put Bridge of Spies and The Post on your list, that means something from my top 10 is not in your list. I have no idea what it could be.
But part of my list was too, like, I also really wanted to represent some contemporary, like, there's thought too of also representing contemporary Spielberg a little bit and stuff.
What year does contemporary Spielberg start in your mind?
I don't know, Amistad. I don't know.
So I certainly have like 2000s plus on my list.
Yeah.
But to me, including, you know, The Post, which probably would have been my 11, you know, there were like at least 12 or 13 movies that, you know, would be top 10 on any other filmmaker's list.
Yeah. That's why like Lincoln not making my list, like it'd be my number 11. Like Lincoln.
I get that.
I don't know that I would rewatch Lincoln, which is part of what came on the list. I think it's an achievement, but it is not like a rewatchable movie.
Raiders, as you know, not my favorite indie movie. Doesn't do what I necessarily want, but it's an incredible movie, an incredible time. Sui generis. And that's kind of all What's that?
Nothing.
Was that incorrect?
No, you're right.
That is really all I have to say about the movie.
So number nine for me is Minority Report. I love it. I think it's great. It's one of his more recent films, but I remember seeing it in 2002, thinking that it felt like old Spielberg. It felt like it just had, you know, just a real sense of adventure. I know that after AI, there was kind of this, I don't know, people didn't like AI. I think AI is great, but people don't like AI, I guess, to some degree. And I think that Minority Report coming out right after AI affected Minority Report in the sense that people thought it was going to be another like, but I think Minority Report has some of the best set pieces he's ever done. I think the whole blind scene when he's in the bathtub and that whole aerial shot over all the apartments with the little bugs and all that sort of shit. Like, it's just classic, great fucking Spielberg. And it's like a film noir movie. So like, I don't know. I think it's great, but that's my number nine. What's your number nine, David?
My Minority Report is probably my 11. So there was a lot of juggling there. And so it was also trying to, like, in the way that I wanted Bridge of Spies to represent some recent stuff, I also wanted to represent some kind of underrated. Mm-hmm. So my number nine is Empire of the Sun.
Oh, wow.
Which I think is not a movie that very many people talk about and probably not a movie that, like, you know, as many people have seen, but I think it is like a real achievement. And I found it really exciting, and like I think Christian Bale's performance is
incredible. Great movie. Yeah, it's a great movie.
Yeah,
Kenny, what's your number nine?
If Raiders perked up some ears, the other Spielberg movie that everyone thinks everyone's crazy about that I only think is great is Jurassic Park, which is my number nine. I only think it's great. This movie is to me. Does very little beyond take you on a ride. The ride is fantastic, but it doesn't have those. Every movie above this, I obviously love more, but I also think it finds something emotionally that Raiders and Jurassic Park don't have for me.
Okay.
They're adventures. The lessons of Jurassic Park are a little less interesting to me than the lessons of some of these other movies. So Jurassic Park, great adventure. It's my number nine.
Okay. I'll talk about Jurassic Park when it comes up on my list. Number eight for me is Saving Private Ryan. I think it's a great movie. It's funny. I really never liked the bookends. Until probably about 2 years ago or so when I rewatched it and realized that it was actually a red herring. And then I was like, oh, okay. I actually kind of like the bookends now. For whatever reason, I never put together that they're trying to tease you or make you think that it's Tom Hanks as the old man, just based on the way that they cut between him at the beginning.
You like it more because of that?
Yeah, yes, I do. Because I think
it's so manipulative.
Fine. But at least it's interesting. Before, it just felt like a device, and I don't particularly like devices. So at least it was trying to do something, which is why I kind of liked it.
It's a device.
Anyway, I like Saving
Private Ryan. It's a great movie. I love Saving Private Ryan. It's on my list.
That's my number eight. What's your eight, David?
Saving Private Ryan, not on my list. I do like it. It's not in my top 10. I think it's probably technically a better movie than I find it a...
Emotional experience.
Sure. My number eight is Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which we touched on a little bit when we talked about Richard Dreyfuss.
Sure.
Feels like one of Spielberg's most personal movies. It's not a movie I've rewatched super recently, but I've always holds a strong place in my heart.
You know,
go ahead, Ken.
I wonder if that's on your list, Phil.
It's not.
It's not on mine either.
I say that only because I watched it years and years ago, liked it. Then I saw it, I went on a date actually, and I saw it in the theater when they did a re-release for it. I don't know, probably 4 or 5 years ago or something like that. I think it's visually stunning. I don't find it as emotionally captivating as I hoped it would be. I can't really speak to why, but for whatever reason, it just never, the character stuff just never really clicked with me. I don't know.
What to do. I don't have it on mine. This is a movie, for whatever reason, always resonated with my parents.
Yeah.
In a way that, like, science fiction doesn't, right? Like, they never made a point of showing me Star Wars, for instance, but they did make a point of showing me Close Encounters. Mm-hmm. So it does have that connection for me, but I find the first hour and 28 minutes of this movie to be really laborious. I think the end is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I respect the idea that, you know, kind of has this Southwest desert Spielberg childhood thing going on. I like that it wears its arm on its sleeve. I'm always, mm-hmm. It's hard on its sleeve. I'm always in favor of more sincerity versus more irony. But I'm with you, Phil, in that in general, it doesn't quite affect me the way I want it to, the way I want to be affected.
What's your name, Kenny?
I respect it. My eight, AI. If you don't like AI, you're dumb, and I hate you.
I love AI. I was really close, but it's not on my list. But it was
AI very close. AI is the first one on my list. That's a 4-star movie out of 4.
It's a great movie.
I think AI is absolutely incredible. It is a little laborious too, but AI has you thinking, has your brain moving with every frame of that movie.
I love it.
I think it's a thrilling experience. I also think the end is like as brutal as things get. So
The movie's insane.
And you want to know what? I kind of desperately want to watch it now with my, you know, kind of, you know, newfound acceptance of my my oncoming demise.
All right. In the next 60 years. My number 7 is Jaws. I know it's low. Jaws is one of those films that I really love when I'm watching it. And then when I'm not watching it, I'm kind of like, I don't know, Jaws, it's good. I don't know. It's one of those movies that I completely understand why everyone thinks it's a masterpiece. And I'm certainly not saying it's not. But it's only 7 on my list, but I love it. It's very good. There are other Spielberg films I love more. What's your 7?
Phil, you don't consider it a masterpiece?
I do. I just think it's a masterpiece at number 7 on my list.
I get that at Jaws, but I think that's, I mean, my Jaws hovered a few different places on my list. So it's higher on my list, but I do get that. Like it is not, it's such an achievement for him and what he did and how, mm-hmm. what it means for his career and the story. And it's a great movie, but as far as like the kinds of movies I choose to love, it's not quite that, but
that's,
it is higher on my list.
That's exactly how I feel. Yeah.
My 7 is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Good movie.
We did a whole podcast on
it. It's a great movie.
I'm
thrilled it made your list because I do think some people are afraid to even put it on their lists.
It was definitely going to be on my list.
It would be on your list.
Yeah.
But I do,
David,
yes,
I'm thrilled it made your list.
It doesn't get quite respect, but I do think it really holds up and it's
absolutely.
You know, I mean, it's nice to have one Spielberg film that covers a relationship between a father and a son. It's one movie where he gets to work that out.
What's
number 7?
It's 7.
Phil, you already had it on your list. I think this is an obvious movie to make list. This is Minority Report. Minority Report is the movie to me that said that Spielberg is never going away. And I don't mean that in a bad way, that he's always going to be playing, like in a James Cameron way, at the leading edge of what we're doing. That despite the fact that he's now in his 60s, he's still going to work with visuals and themes that are far beyond his peers who work at that budget. I love Minority Report. I think Minority Report's a fucking awesome movie.
I think Minority Report is... I think the 2002, when he released Minority Report in the summer, he released Catch Me If You Can at Christmas. I think both those films don't get the love that they deserve. Both of them were, you know, obviously box office successes.
I think one of them does.
But that's one of those years where I remember thinking like, this guy's playing at the top of his fucking game right now. And instead you guys are like giving the hours a Best Picture nomination. And I'm just like, hey, whatever. So there you go. My number 6 is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. We did a whole podcast on it. It's a great movie. What's your number 6, David?
My number 6, just mentioned, is Catch Me If You Can. which to me is, I think is a great movie and also feels like a movie that I would be surprised if I didn't know Spielberg directed it. That would surprise me. Mm-hmm. Except now I have to readjust. It also a movie about a man's relationship with his father. I realize Spielberg actually has two movies about a man's relationship.
Only two though. Only two.
I didn't realize, but no, it's the visually great. Yeah, it's a great example of how to adapt a true story that not everyone knows. I think there's a lot of great. Amy Adams gives an incredible performance.
It's also just, you know, it was the first time I think we saw Leonardo DiCaprio having a good time as well, like letting go of all of his like bullshit and just being a fun movie star. It's a beautiful looking movie, to your point, like that the period stuff is all fantastic. It's a tremendous score from John Williams. I think it's a really, really, really good movie that people unfortunately
I disagree with you in that people don't think that it's a good movie. I mean, it's higher on my list. I love this movie. And I think To Catch Me If You Can is one of the last movies that kind of fall into that new canon thing. That thing that, that the Shawshank thing, the Fargo thing, the thing that like that families kind of watch together by default. Catch Me If You Can is a fantastic film in every way. I love Spielberg for doing that for DiCaprio with DiCaprio. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. DiCaprio, at that point of his career, I think made a point that he was only going to work with the best possible filmmakers in whatever they wanted him to do. Yeah. So Spielberg said, we want you to, you know, we want you to be like a bare knuckle boxer in 1912. He would have done it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But the fact that he let him have some fun and play to his strength, not that I don't think really Leo has any weaknesses, but to play to his strengths, I thought was fantastic.
I think that Catch Me If You Can, which if I'm being honest is my number five. So it's coming up. But I think that it's, unfortunately, people thought it was slight. I think that people kind of were like, oh, this is Spielberg and it's fun and it's his North by Northwest or whatever. It's like him just sort of peak of his powers, knows what he's doing. And I think that's why the only Oscar nomination it gets, shockingly, is for Chris Walken, who's very good in the movie, but I'm just sort of surprised that, you know, that he's the one who gets
it. It's an interesting point because at the time, we were still in a world, and this is going to sound like maybe kind of bullshitty, but I believe it, we're still in a world where Citizen Kane would top the sight and sound list every year. Now we're in a world where Vertigo tops the sound list every year. Not every 10 years. Yeah. There is a difference in the way people look at these kind of movies now than then.
Sure.
You know,
I agree with that.
Catch Me If You Can I think it's considered Spielberg's best movie of the last 25 years.
What's your number six?
My number six is the movie right before that. Saving Private Ryan. Saving Private Ryan is probably the last of the first period of Spielberg, or maybe the last of the second period of Spielberg. I like it less, I think, than I did in the moment.
Sure.
When I saw it in the theaters, I sat there and sobbed.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I was like no movie I've ever seen, just sobbed.
Yeah.
And I don't think it would ever – it's never had that effect on me since, but any movie that could draw that kind of emotion out of you. I mean, just a spectacular film.
So. Yeah, it's. I mean, I remember seeing Saving Private Ryan in the theater. You know, that D-Day sequence, the Normandy sequence, is unbelievable. I still feel like I'm emotionally scarred by Adam Goldberg's death in that film. There's a lot going on in that movie. Anyway, my number five is Catch Me If You Can, which we've talked about. So, what's your number five, David?
My number five is Jaws, which we talked about.
There you go.
My number five is a movie we haven't talked about, and I feel like it isn't going to be on your list, Phil.
Okay.
I don't know about you, David. The other film that I think is like an amazing achievement and not a Spielbergian film at all, Munich. What a movie.
Not a movie.
We brought it up on this podcast before, but I think Munich is one of the best movies for adults I've ever seen.
It's not on my list because it's you know, not some of these movies are perfect and it's not quite perfect, but I love it. I love Munich. Yeah.
And I, as you know, I've been saying I kind of want to do a Munich on all the people in the Trump administration. So anybody who wants in, let me know.
So when you say that, do you mean hire people to murder the people that are in the Trump
administration? I want to be like, I want to be Eric Bana and do the murdering. You could be my you could be my Daniel Craig if you'd like.
Are you sure you saw Munich? Because I'm positive that the moral of Munich is not to
don't do murder. No, the moral the, Munich is one of the rare movies where violence is the answer. So we'll go do more violence on the Trumps.
I think Munich is a great film. I think that. I hate to say this, but I'm going to say it. The sex scene at the end of that film is so brazenly insane and terrible that it leaves a lasting impression. I understand on paper why he thought cross-cutting between him having sex with his wife and the murders of these people might have made sense. But the slow motion sweat and the whole fuck, it's so crazy that it immediately...
That's how Israelis have sex.
Yeah, so get out a little more.
Yeah, I'm sorry. My number four is Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park, 1993. You can roll your eyes all you want. 1993, I remember reading that book before it came out. It was one of the first like adult books I had ever read in terms of just like a book that was... You know,
I think those quotes are appropriate.
It was just a big deal for me. I was very excited for it. Went to see a late night early screening of it with my mom. It's just a great movie that still really kind of holds up for me. And 93, we'll talk about Schindler's List as well. But like, you know, I'm 13. It's the year that made me want to go to film school and write movies and be in this industry. So it was so formative that it's impossible for me to separate those things. But David, what's your number four?
My number four is also Jurassic Park. I had the same experience as you did. I also went to a late night screening with your mom. I think this is, it is what Steven Spielberg does. So, I mean, it is, you know, it's mixing that technical, you know, like James Cameron's so good at the technical part, not as good at the, and it's not like Jurassic Park is an emotional movie, but you understand everyone's stakes in it, and everyone is believable, and there's almost no fat in that movie. Yep. I mean, it just works.
It's not an emotional movie. I agree. Feel that pretty strongly that it's a thrill ride. It's a horror movie, but there are no personal stakes in this movie. The stakes are life and death, which is great. Sure. But I don't know if there's any stakes in terms of for these characters on kind of a non-existential level.
Sure.
Whereas like T2, I feel differently about Cameron. T2 is...
T2 is an exception, I think. But I think a lot of his stuff is like he has a toy box. I guess I'm more thinking of later era Avatar Part 5.
Avatar and Jurassic Park are very similar for me. And I say that as someone who really enjoyed my Avatar experience.
Fair enough.
Actually, I think Avatar is more emotional than Jurassic Park.
Well, I guess I'm talking about the emotional stuff. I'm talking about is that I care about all of the people. I'm not saying that they have to build a bullshit thing about like what's going to happen to them the next day, and if the experiences and the events of Jurassic Park have like helped, you know, solve their sort of like human emotional life problems, but in a way that Jurassic World, I don't care about the people. There is something about having, you know, human beings interacting with puppets and CGI characters that feels really terrifying and real, and you do care about it.
I think there's a weird thing to say, but I Jurassic Park is like a Cracker Jack movie. It's pretty much perfect for what it's trying to do. And yet it doesn't measure up to his better films. That's all. I think that it's an excellent movie. I wouldn't have put it in my top 10 if I didn't.
What's your number four, Kenny?
My number four I'm sure it's a great movie. Catch Me If You Can. Already talked about it. Movie rocks.
My number three is Schindler's List. I'm not going to do a whole thing on this. I'll just say that I saw this film in the theater with my grandparents, who are both Holocaust survivors, and it was a eye-opening experience for me. I was 13. I'm not sure that I fully understood what they lived through until I saw that film. It just changed the way that I saw movies. And as we said earlier, and it's the reason why it's not on your list, Kenny, on some level, it transcends the medium, if that's the right way to put it. It is in its own category. It seems crazy to say that there are two other films that I think are better than it. Like, it's sort of an absurd thing to even rank. But it was a very powerful experience for me. It was a very formative experience for me. And I'd be remiss if I didn't at least put it on the list. So that's my number three.
Yeah, my number three is also Schindler's List. I also saw it with Phil's grandparents. But I will.
Great joke, even the second time.
I'll push back to what, like, I think what Kenny, what you said, which I think is what I sort of thought of Schindler's List after seeing it, is like, what an emotional journey, like what a document of this time and these horrors, what a movie I never want to see again. But in the intervening years, I have seen it again. And I think on a different level, it actually works as a movie and a thriller. Sure. And there is, like, certainly in the first hour, there is, like, legitimate comedy to it. I mean, like, Schindler is like a con artist who's extremely charismatic, and it really is your way in which I think other kinds of movies that are just tragedy, like, there's just movies that are just meant to just make you leave mm-hmm. and feel like shit, which I think there is a lot of movies that do that, and a lot of movies that do that well. But, you know, there is this sort of thing that feels like Schindler's List kind of eases you in to make it. And I think the black and white just does it to make you feel like you're watching kind of like a slick throwback, like, you know, Casablanca era movie. And then they show you the real horrors and tragedy. And I think it's like incredible that his talent allowed him to do that.
I guess what I would say is everything you said is true, and I certainly don't fault you guys for putting a Spielberg film on the list of favorite Spielberg films. It seems appropriate. I always had this feeling when I would look at film history or look at Oscar winners or see Schindler's List in a montage of film history, where it just doesn't feel like it belongs with every other film ever made, because it feels almost like you are patronizing the movie by giving it an award. You're patronizing the movie by putting it in the same montage as Gone with the Wind or Casablanca or Citizen Kane or almost anything else. I mean, the only movies I could think of that have this gravity and kind of urgency are documentaries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because documentaries, you know, actually document horror. I kind of felt that way about that Josh Oppenheimer movie, The Act of Killing. Mm-hmm. So it's personal. Like, this was a personal decision, sure, obviously, but it just didn't feel right to even put it on the list. It just didn't feel like, guys, this is a better movie than E.T. It's a better piece of art than E.T., but I don't want to put it like on a list next to E.T. just feels totally ridiculous.
I hear that.
I get it.
I also, yeah, just, I, yes, sir. Go ahead. Do it.
No, I think it was also like, I think when you get down to it, and this is what I texted Phil before we did that, like, some of these movies are like tied. Yeah. I have two movies above Schindler's List, but I mean, if I'm going to, like, you know, I can be convinced to change my list at any
time. I think I know what those two movies are.
Yeah. I think
because they're the only two left.
Ready Player One is one of them.
So you guys both had Schindler's List at three.
Well, I want to say one quick thing about Schindler's List that I think is worth just highlighting, because I just was thinking about it as we were talking, and it's not something that I've ever really thought about before. But it's worth noting that, you know, Spielberg does Always, he does Hook, And then in the same year, he does Jurassic Park and Schindler's List. It's worth saying how much of a risk making Schindler's List is at this point in his career. He has not proven himself necessarily to be adroit with this type of material, right? Like, Empire of the Sun has elements of war in it. But there's this idea of the bar of how high he had set for himself to clear to make this movie. And that he does, I think... It's not just impressive because he did it, but it's also just, I guess it's just worth stating that to do Jurassic Park and Schindler's List in the same year, to try to adapt a book that he had the rights to for a very long time and wasn't sure how to do it and wasn't sure he was ready, and this and that he actually executed and did a great job and did it. It's just worth showing how hard that must have been.
I'd say, you know, look, it didn't make any of our list and we haven't even discussed it. But The Color Purple is a dress rehearsal for this. And The Color Purple is another one of these movies where it felt like you just don't even bother with Oscars. That's just not what this movie's about.
I think Spielberg at the time would disagree.
I agree.
I really wanted that Oscar.
I know he would, but I'm sure I know that was a thing. I'm sure by the time he won it for Schindler's List, it felt like nothing. Like it just I don't know. I wouldn't have cared. Like, guys, sometimes it's in the work, isn't it? Okay.
I just want to say one quick thing about The Color Purple since you brought it up very quickly.
Yes.
13 Academy Award nominations. It goes home completely empty-handed. Is one of the bigger fuck yous the Academy has ever done.
No, it's not a fuck you, because why would anyone say fuck you to The Color Purple?
I mean. It's Spielberg, not to the film.
I do know what you
film.
Mean, but it, the whole, it's a shitty, shitty fucking part of its legacy.
Yes, that, it is that, a shitty part of
that, that's,
yes.
That's something that correct. Like ha, that I think you're 100% right bringing it up, but that's something the Academy did to that movie.
I agree.
And when we trivialize movies like that with awards, don't get me wrong, I love awards. When we trivialize movies like that with awards, you wind up with sometimes with things like 13 nominations and no wins, and that's like so stupid.
Or Driving Miss Daisy winning.
Well, that's, you know, that's also stupid in its own way. So
what's your number three?
I'm gonna give you my number three. We talked about it. Jaws. Don't know why it's not higher. The fucking movie's perfect. It's a perfect horror film. It's a perfect human drama. It's a perfect like distillation of what it feels like to be over your head. I think the camera works perfect. I think the performances are like out of control. I think it's the only time I found Richard Dreyfuss to be like someone I wanted to chill with for a little bit. Like I actually love his kind of energy in this movie.
Yeah, he's great.
It's a weirdly a great movie to show to your like kids as they're growing up and learning about like what makes for a cool movie.
Sure.
And I don't blame you guys wrapping it lower because it's Spielberg and there's so many good Spielberg movies.
I did two slots lower.
But yeah, you gotta have it somewhere there because it's fucking Jaws. I know what Phil's number one is. I'm the only one who has a different one than you two. You guys have the same one and two. I just know the answer to that.
I'm sure we have the same one and two, yeah.
I mean, my number two is Raiders. My number one is E.T.
Same for you, David?
Yeah, yes.
All right, so my number two is Last Crusade. And we played this out in the Last Crusade podcast. I think it's a better movie than Raiders. We obviously all have our indie movie. Let's talk about E.T. Unless you guys want to talk about Raiders. Sorry.
I only want to talk about Raiders. I'll talk about Raiders in the that like because I have it, weirdly it's a genre of movie. Mm-hmm. Like the sort of adventure treasure hunt kind of movie.
Yeah, yeah.
That I've tried to sell movies with that theme. There's ones that come up every once in a while. It's a weird genre that everyone kind of wants more of.
Yep.
And nobody can do.
Hard to crack.
It is like almost impossible. I mean, Da Vinci Code, a huge hit. I mean, that movie, rewatching it outside of the hype of that book being successful is like almost an incoherent movie. But and Goonies is kind of a kid's version, and Romancing the Stone doesn't actually work as an adventure story. And, you know, so there are attempts of this time after time after time. And the fact that like they invented I didn't invent the genre because it's a throwback to old movies, but that it is like almost an unduplicatable thing. And it's been unduplicatable it's only been, you know, in four tries of Indiana Jones movies, they've done it successfully twice and unsuccessfully twice. Yeah.
I mean, Temple of Doom, I kind of ride for Temple of Doom to some degree, only the beginning and the end, but I know what you're saying. Yeah.
David, your point about everyone wants to do it, it's
true.
I do feel to some extent that people have given up a little bit, but when I first moved out here, mm-hmm. how many times did I hear people say, I want to do My Romancing the Stone, I want to do my Raiders, I want to do my Goonies.
Yeah.
Those were really touchstone-y movies in the beginning. And yeah, people have kind of like given up. And the best examples we've had are, you know, The Mummy, which I think is fine, but not good. The National Treasure movies, which I think are fine, but not good. It's very hard. And then movies that are just disasters. Like there have just been disastrous attempts at doing this that have cost people tons of money.
It is. I mean, to David's point,
and the Jumanji remakes are attempts at it, which are like they don't. Which being that they're like winking at it allows them to not fully.
I think those movies are tens out of tens, but they don't feel like those. They don't feel like Raiders to me, for whatever reason. I think those movies rock. But
yeah.
On the ET front, it's interesting. I watched Super 8 the other night with my roommate because she has a project that she wanted to rewatch it for. And I was like, sure, we can watch it. That movie is just wrought with problems. Watching it this time, I was just like, this thing is insane. Like, I don't know how this thing got through. But all that being said, the attempt, it's one of, and many people have tried to do ET in some form or another. Watched ET recently for my AFI club thing that I've been doing, and it's just unimpeachably perfect. Like, I just honestly don't think there's a false beat in it. I don't think there's a false shot in it. I think that the subtext of divorce that's coursing through the whole thing is done pitch perfectly. I mean, I remember years and years and years ago, Spielberg was interviewed by, I think it was either Ebert or Siskel, and they asked him, you can have one film to leave behind. What's the film? And he's like, well, it would have to be E.T. Like, even he knows that it's the quintessential Spielberg film. I don't think that anything really touches it in terms of the emotions, the fact that he fucking goes home at the end, that there were no sequels, like that it is just its own animal. I think it's a perfect movie.
I watched it about a month ago. I agree with you. It's flawless. It is like, you know, also just a, such a fascinating window into that era, like in a way that you don't, like a Stranger Things sort of tries to do a period piece set in that era. But I think nothing tells you the story more what the early 80s felt like than simply the fact that like the mom had to work and the kids were able to hide an alien. I was trying to like write a joke after I watched it where but I couldn't quite crack it, which was just essentially the idea of like every kid in that movie, like trying to explain their future partner about this thing that happened and like, and knowing that like when you get to like that serious of a level of a relationship, like how does like 28-year-old Elliot not tell his girlfriend like about the ET experience? She's never gonna buy it.
Yeah.
That's I don't know. I mean, they'll never do it, but that's the Cobra Kai version of this show. ET doesn't come back. There is no ET. Yeah. It is just 28-year-old Elliot. You could do that with
you could absolutely do that.
Can I have it?
That's a great idea. It really is. What are your thoughts on E.T., Kenny?
I think it's the best fucking movie. I think it's the best movie. I don't know if it's my favorite movie, but watching E.T. is such an unbelievable, unparalleled joy. I don't think I've ever seen it on the big screen, which I'd like to remedy very soon. But
did I ever tell you my E.T. story about when I was a kid? It's very brief. My parents took me to see it. I was two. I was very young. I did not know what I was about to sit down in. The moment early in the film when E.T. When Elliot goes outside and sees E.T. in the tall grass, and he's all like, and he like screams at him. I started crying. I just like went to sleep and that was all that I saw of the film. My parents thought that I loved it though, bought me E.T. sheets. So I was surrounded by the thing that scares me most, and they wonder why I had sleeping problems when I was a child. But
that is immersion therapy. That's a good, they did a very
it's exposure thing. Therapy. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, totally.
Okay, so
yes.
There are only two movies that I kind of feel this way about, E.T. and Back to the Future, where I just kind of want to bathe in the film, yeah. Where I just want that film to wash over me, which I will choose to watch it almost over almost anything else. You guys said everything, but it's really not even about the moments, all of which are fucking perfect. The performances are perfect. The puppetry is perfect. Like, it's just everything's perfect, but it is that feeling. And like, you know, I said this on a different podcast that we were on, the idea of I love watching movies. I don't really love period movies as much as I like watching movies made in the period. Mm-hmm. And this is the only movie that really lets me understand what it's like to be a latchkey kid, you know, what totally. That really probably felt like in the moment. Mm-hmm. And I love it.
There's a moment when, I mean, Gert is five, yeah. where the mom is like, where there's an Elliot emergency at school. And she's just like, all right, you just stay here. like can you imagine just leaving your child? Like your 5-year old child.
It was the height of America.
Yeah.
There was something perfect.
American exceptionalism
that.
Where you could just there's like, you know,
perfect about that moment in time. That just it all kind of worked. That's the moment I'd want to go back to.
I also just want to say one other thing about E.T. that I think is worth noting. And every time I watch it, it hits me every time. I have the score on vinyl, which I've listened to many times. But when you see the confluence of that John Williams score when E.T. and him are flying over, you know, over the city, and it gives you goosebumps. It is the personification of what the movie going experience is supposed to be. It is transportive.
I feel that way.
It's unbelievable. It gives me goosebumps every fucking time. It's unbelievable stuff.
And what I love about it is that there is really no precursor for it.
Yeah.
Like this is not Star Wars. This is not Frankenstein. This is not King Kong. This is not any of those. This is the first attempt at doing this thing.
Yep.
And they just fucking
killed it
so far in the park.
I'll give one last like it. Yeah. I rewatched it with someone who hadn't seen it in long enough that she did not know what was going to happen. And there are so many moments where you just there's not a movie that builds up there is no way to get out of this when he is seemingly sick in the ravine, when he is declared dead, there's just simply, you're like, oh, that's what this movie is. Like, this is a movie about a child getting over loss. And I'm on the ride, but like that a movie could put so many obstacles to writing itself. And it does. It's just
what I'm going to say one last thing, cause I know we all need to move on with our lives, but I'm going to say this one last thing. Watching it the last time and watching it maybe the last few times, the thing that hit me as well, we're all writers here. There is not that much dialogue in this movie, all things considered. This film could very well be a silent film. The amount of information that is conveyed in this film just in that first act with Elliot and E.T. in terms of the through motion or through just visual information between the two of them as opposed to actual dialogue. It's a beautiful, beautiful movie, and it shows one of Spielberg's unbelievable abilities to be able to tell a story silently. You know, he does it in Schindler's List. He does it in, I mean, doesn't really do it in Always, but like just really being able to sort of take you, it's very Capra-esque in terms of telling you a story through visual sort of storytelling. It's truly incredible. It's amazing stuff. Anyway, David, thank you so much for being here to talk about this
David.
Ridiculous Happily. Film. Later. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it.
Podcast like it's 1989. Baby fish mouth. Ethel baby Mermaid. Fish mouth.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.